And start recording, please, Brittany. And
it looks like it's trying. There we go.
Okay. Thank you. And welcome, everyone, to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District No. 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. We are still under the COVID-19 notice pursuant to Governor Inslee's proclamation of 2028. So we are still having no in-house meetings. This will be a three-part meeting again, and we will begin with a board governance education session that will run from now until approximately 2:30, at which time we will go into an education topic of population health with Dunia Falks, our population health director. That will run until 3:15, where we have a break, and then we'll come back at 3:30 for our business section of the meeting. It will hopefully conclude at the latest by 6:30. The times that are shown are estimates only, and we are recording this publicly. So at this time, I'll ask, is Case here?
It doesn't look like it.
Yeah, okay. I don't see him connected. I will see if I can reach his line at home.
All right, great. Thank you, Brittany. I really don't want to start the meeting, this section of it, without all the commissioners present. So we'll wait until Case is available for us.
Did anybody hear the our legislators' town hall on Monday evening?
I did not.
I did not.
Did Matt?
No.
No. For some reason, I don't know, I get a phone call and my husband gets an email. But it was pretty good, and I just wanted to let everybody know that Mike Chapman in particular mentioned the sterling job that both OMC and Jefferson Healthcare has been doing, and Jamestown Clallam, and in taking care of our residents, our citizens, and was very complimentary about how well we all worked, Jefferson Healthcare, with the public, the county health people, and how well that was working. Because a question did come up from a citizen regarding not being in a lump together with Kitsap and Clallam is one big area, and not supporting that, asked how they felt and wanted them to be against it. But they were very complimentary about Jefferson and working with the health department, and also with Clallam, and as I say, Jamestown Clallam, Clallam County and OMC and Jamestown Clallam Tribe. So I thought you ought to know that.
Great. That's good news.
It's yeah, nice. Mike Chapman was very complimentary.
Good. There he is.
He's all back.
Right. Are you all set and ready to go, Case? Can you hear us?
He's muted.
Case?
You're muted, Case. You're still muted.
We can't hear you.
How about now?
Yes.
My computer just totally crashed on me, so I had to reboot.
Oh, my gosh. There must be something in the stars or something. Planet.
Okay, I'm here.
All right. We have gone through the preamble of the meeting, and so now we will just dive right into our board governance education session. All right.
Turn off my phone and we're good to go.
So, Case, are you ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay. Matt, you're ready?
I am ready.
All right. And Mari, you're ready?
I'm ready.
All right. And I can see Bruce. Okay. Well, the first order of business is a report on the progress of Commissioner Reddy's question regarding his right to record public meetings on his personal equipment. And it referred to two meetings in particular, one in 2014 and one in 2016. And if you recall, I appointed Matt and Mari to explore outside legal counsel to address those questions. And during the preliminary search, new information was discovered. And I will go ahead and turn this over to Mari to bring us up to speed on what happened and what transpired, and then I will go from there. So Mari, can you bring us up to date on your findings?
Yes, what happened is I did have a telephone conversation with Matt and then proceeded as he had agreed for me to get in touch with Ogden Murphy Wallace, which is a prestigious law firm in Seattle with several hundred, I believe, at least a significant number of attorneys who work for them. And so I left a voicemail with the legal assistant of a group of attorneys there who do their specialty, I guess, is municipal. Municipalities, if I get the word out correctly, and it took some time actually to get a response, and the response was from the particular one that I named. I just took a stab at one of the names. Was the fact that and apologized for the delay, because I guess they do due diligence to find out if there any of their partners and colleagues are working in any way, shape, or form with the entity, with Jefferson Healthcare or the Public Hospital District. So the response was that they had, or he had, contacted our in-house counsel in regards to my request. And my request was, do you deal with this type of issue? And I'd like to express further. And that was the voicemail I left because of no details. And so the response was that they contacted our legal counsel, John French, and that they felt that there was could well be a conflict of interest because of other work they were working on in a different attorney, different system, about a different subject. So then I did speak to John French regarding this, and he was in agreement with their opinion that this wasn't going to go anywhere. And in the meantime, I think there was more thought to put into it from the district's point of view and the district's, what the responsibility was of the district and how the board and the district are separate. And so with that, I'll hand it over to Jill, because that's as far as I got.
Okay. So subsequent to that, Mr. French came up with a letter to the board explaining that, in his opinion, this was a board issue and not a district issue. The issue of Matt's personal rights is a personal issue, and it really has nothing to do with the board's business or the duties of a public hospital district commissioner. It's a matter of, were his rights violated by members of the board? In looking further into it, it was decided that to talk to our insurance carrier, who ruled that apparently it's not all that uncommon for board members to sue other board members individually. And for that reason, they don't carry directors and officers insurance that includes the litigation between other between board members that are of a personal nature as this is. So they put us on notice that they would not be covering us, any of us, in any way. So this is a board issue. It's not a district issue. And it's been recommended by our in-house attorney, by our insurance carrier, by our risk manager, and by outside Brad Berg earlier, that we do not pursue this in this manner, because it is personal. We do not want to spend district funds on personal business. There could also be legal action if Commissioner Reddy decides that he wants to take us to court individually. Then, if we're paying for an attorney to come up with evidence against us, that just really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So for that reason, I am strongly recommending that we reverse our initial action of considering to hire an outside attorney to pursue this. I talked to Matt about this. Matt and I had a conversation on Saturday. He's aware of this. So I offered to work with Matt on a personal basis. And the other question was, were we following Robert's Rules of Order during these two meetings? In doing the research on that, I discovered that we were not actually under Robert's Rules of Order, because the first meeting that took place in 2014 was when we were still under Carver's policy governance, and Carver does not recommend Robert's Rules of Order. So that was totally off the table then. And by 2016, which was in June, in March of 2016, we started looking at other forms of governance, and we decided to go with our board book. And so we began that in March. The board book, the first mention of Robert's Rules of Order came about in March of 2016, but it was not adopted. The board book was not formally adopted until July of 2016. So during that transition period between Carver's policy governance and our development and ratification of going to the board book, that meeting took place, the second meeting that Commissioner Reddy is referencing took place in June. We didn't ratify it and put it into effect until July. So technically, we weren't under the guidance of Robert's Rules at that time either. So I asked Matt if he would like to work with me to say, okay, well, hypothetically, what could we learn from this? Could we take this and say what would have happened if we had been under Robert's Rules? So we thought that it would be good for the commission, if you wanted to do that, to explore that on that basis. But he also knows that I am recommending strongly against going forward with hiring outside legal counsel to address his questions. And so that being said, I ask for any comments from the other commissioners regarding the situation. And I know that I sent to you copies of Mr. French's letter regarding the legal ramifications of this. So number one, have you had a chance to look at the letter that I sent on Saturday. And do you have any comments regarding, what are your comments regarding this situation? Who would like to go first?
Could I ask a question, Jill?
Yes, of course. This is up for discussion.
Yeah, good. I'd love to hear first from Matt what his thoughts are, since you did have an opportunity to speak with him and he knows what's on the table and what your recommendation is. So that would be my preference, is to hear from Matt first, since he is the one who had requested, had sent out the list of questions and specifically requested us to take that previous action.
Certainly. Matt, do you have what?
Yeah, I'm happy. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Should we read John French's letter so that people understand what we're talking about?
I can't quite. It's garbled. Your message was garbled to me. I couldn't understand what you're saying.
Jill, you wanted to.
Can you guys hear me better now?
Yeah.
Yes.
I was just wondering if we should read, could someone read aloud John French's letter just so that we have, you know, the actual context of what the legal counsel said?
I'll be happy to do that. I have it here. Is that something that the commissioners would like? I think they've all had a chance to read it. Do you want to take the time reading it, rereading it?
Well, just the, I could read the first part. I guess basically it says that the questions are personal legal questions. And I think the seven questions, I don't think you could say that they're all personal legal questions. The question of did the board or the hospital district violate the law at either of those two meetings is not a personal legal question. Did we violate the Open Public Meetings Act? I think it's a very appropriate question for the board to check on. And then the question of, the question of, who was appropriately trying to fulfill their oath of office is, again, that's sort of like, it's not a personal question. That's a question of, are we doing the right thing, of how we govern the board? If you wanted to eliminate the personal rights questions from the list, I guess you could argue that. I still think those would be very useful things to know, but I think you're throwing out all seven questions when there's only two of them that relate to personal rights. I think it's kind of overboard. I think the board would really benefit from unbiased legal counsel. I think that the current lawyers for the hospital district might have a conflict of interest with this issue, because they've been involved in this for the last 7 years. So I think it really would, be smart for the board to have unbiased, independent legal counsel give the board advice on what to do. And the first question could be, what questions are appropriate for the board to investigate as a board? So we could take it slow. So anyways, that would be my recommendation.
Well, if I can respond to that a little bit.
Well, can we hear from the other commissioners?
Well, I would like to make it clear that that we are not debating the letter and the context of the letter. What we're debating, what we're talking about, is whether or not we want to go forward with this. We have spent a lot of resources on this already, and this is so far removed from the real work we're doing. I don't want to get into nitpicking about what who said what and which questions are which. I am not of a legal, I don't have the expertise to judge those things. I think the main question here is whether we want to pursue an outside attorney to look into these questions when we've already had some explanations by, we've already addressed most of them, and I don't want to spend any more resources on this, especially district resources, when we're in a precarious situation right now anyway with COVID. I don't want to spend one more dime on this. So this is of a personal nature. It's going to be up to us to, if you want to pursue this, as I told you the other, when we discussed this, there's another avenue, and that is through MRSC. And that is an neutral, they are attorneys who are proficient in and specialize in municipal and open public meetings and open public records acts, that you can go to them and pursue this all you want with no cost. And that's what I would recommend. So I will now step back and open it again to the commissioners, the other commissioners, but I did want to make that clear.
Can I just say I did ask the MRSC about it, and they said to ask district council.
Okay, which
happened. Oh, I'd be happy to chime in. Could you clarify, please, Jill, how much time we have? According to our agenda, this was going to transition at 2:30.
Yes.
It's
2:26 right now.
I understand that. So I'm trying to... I want to make sure that if we are going to discuss this further, that all of us have an equal opportunity to speak. And according to my watch, we have 3 minutes left, which means that we all have 1 minute, and it seems like we're not going to be able to finish this in an adequate way. So I think what I would recommend is that we identify a time when we can finish this discussion. In a way so that we're doing our own due diligence. I mean, I can give you my opinion in 10 seconds, which is I would agree that we should not pursue this with legal counsel. But I have a lot to say leading up to that, or that a lot of information that I personally have found to back that up, my opinion at this time.
Maybe we should start the next meeting, April meeting, with the education time at 2:00 to further deal with this, as we have 2 minutes left.
I think that's a good idea. That do the rest of what how do the rest of you feel? Bruce, you haven't said anything yet.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I was not on the board at the time. So I'm not directly involved with what happened. I believe that if the meetings were recorded in any manner, the Open Public Meetings Act was not violated. And I'm happy with the way the boards meetings are being recorded now, and the way it's set up in the board book if somebody uses their own personal device to record. So I have no interest in getting outside legal counsel to look at this at all.
All right. Matt?
Yes.
Do you have any further comments?
Well, we haven't heard from Mari, have we? I mean, I guess she gave us her update.
I just did, but I'm in total agreement with Bruce. Because, mm-hmm. you know, this is, I think the way to go is through MRSC. If you want to pursue it yourself, Matt, I have no problem with that. But, you know, first of all, it's wasting a lot of the board's time. But also, you know, this is a time when we should be focused more on the situation in the, you know, for the hospital district and get on with doing our job. But I'm quite willing, if a case has a lot to say about it, to go ahead and have a you know, start the next meeting with a half an hour discussion. But I'm in total agreement with Bruce.
Yeah. And let me suggest, I did speak with MRSE yesterday, Steve Gross, and the kind of question that Matt is raising is not one that MRSE would answer. They ask you to go get personal legal advice. However, they will interpret the Open Public Meetings Act. And he did that, do that for me. And it clarifies that anyone, whether you're a board member or a patient or whoever, anyone is allowed to record meetings on their own personal devices. So, and how that relates to this, I can talk about that later, but we are obviously out of time.
I think that if there's a motion, we could get this settled and then discuss it at the next meeting if you wanted to look into other aspects of it. But if it sounds to me like you're ready to vote, but I will go with the will of the board. And if there's a motion forthcoming, we will go ahead and proceed that way. If not, then we will table this until the next meeting.
Okay, can I ask a clarifying question? Are the legal opinion, the letter from John French and the legal opinion we were provided by Brad Berg that was emailed to all the commissioners, can I just confirm those are public record, right? There's no,
right.
Those are a matter of public,
yes,
record, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, I do not hear a motion, so we will table.
All right. I will move that we do not send a letter, or that we do not send a request for outside legal counsel at this time.
Second. Yes, I second.
Is there discussion?
And I would recommend that we do discuss it further at the next meeting, particularly with regards to the questions of Robert's Rules of Order and how we can best deal with this kind of issue in the future.
I think that's quite an amendment to your motion.
No, that's not an amendment. That's just a side comment. Recommendation. Just a side comment.
Then that's not part of the motion then.
That is correct.
Okay. So the motion is to not proceed with the outside legal counsel. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. It's been motioned and seconded that we will not pursue outside legal counsel to address these issues of Commissioner Reddy. Is there any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Well, can I just say, I strongly disagree with that motion, but I totally understand everyone being incredibly sick of this issue, because I am too.
All right. Okay, thank you, Matt. All right, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Those opposed?
Nay.
All right, thank you, everybody. And we will go ahead and take this up then, use this as an education tool for next board governance in next month's meeting. And without further ado, I'm sorry, Dunia, we intruded on your time. But please, we're going to go right into this meeting now to talk about population health with Dunia, and I see Dr. Parker on there too. Hey, welcome.
Thank you so much. And Brittany, will you have the slides up for us as well? Possibly.
Yes, sorry, it's just a lot of bouncing around the screen.
Totally. Really appreciate it. And yes, I did ask Dr. Parker to join me. I think that this is at least the second, if not the third board meeting that you all have seen me. And so I wanted to sort of spice it up a little bit with Molly, who always adds such awesome commentary and information. And so this is just a population health update for 2021. We have continued our work pretty strongly over the last year. Of course, COVID has definitely derailed that. You've heard a lot about our equity work. I'm going to talk about that again today in more detail about some of the things that we've been working on. But also, I don't want to forget all the amazing work that Dr. Parker and Tina have been doing around specifically child care and food as well. And so next slide, please. We're going to talk about friends, the first 1,000 days, which, as you know, is the most important time, a little bit about our food work, and then we'll end the day with equity here. Next slide. And I'm going to hand it right over to Molly.
All right. Thanks for having us. So diving right into friends, part of our work, as you know, has been on child care, and we've broken that into two prongs during COVID. One is that we've stepped into the subsidy world and with Jefferson Healthcare subsidizing employees who need it for their child care during COVID. As you can imagine, a lot of our employees' families had changes in their employment and their ability to find child care and to also work at the same time. And so we were able to open up some funding to support them. To date, we've spent $21,000. This is just a little bit, the numbers you see there are a little bit less than our most recent numbers. We've supported 13 different families and 20 kids. And we've worked on this directly with three licensed childcare groups in the county. All of our employees get their information on this from the Human Resources SharePoint page, and so if you want to go to that page and check it out, you can. It's been really appreciated. A lot of our employees tell us that they would have really struggled getting through this time without the extra funding. And then partnering with us was the Jefferson Healthcare Foundation. They were able to raise just under $60,000 also to subsidize our employees. They've been able to subsidize families who are out of county, who may have unlicensed child care, for example, a nanny or a neighbor who might be taking care of their kids for funding. And so they've been able to help a lot more families. Their work has crossed 17 of our departments, 26 different families, 52 kids, and has funded 16 different caregivers. And they will have enough money, they believe, to go through June. They're hoping to get through the end of the summer at least, and so are still taking donations for that if anyone is interested. So next slide, please. One of the other projects that we had been working on in our friends category is social isolation. And in 2019, just before the pandemic hit, we got to be a part of a study that the University of Washington did on social isolation, particularly looking at a screening tool for patients in primary care. We were one of the few rural sites, I think there were 5 sites total, where they demonstrated their screening tool. And our primary care providers volunteered to have their patients be use the screener if the patients were interested. The patients were enrolled through the UW study program, and I believe they got a little gift certificate for participating. The data is just coming out now, which is why you're hearing about it now. And it is really fascinating to me thinking about the level of isolation that there was even prior to COVID. So if you look at this, of the participants who were surveyed, and this is at all 5 sites, not just ours, 40 to 50% of the participants felt isolated, that no one really knew them well, that they didn't have a good friend group, or that they worried about being by themselves. They couldn't find companionship when they wanted it and missed having people around them. That's a lot of people who are lonely. 1 in 5 participants avoided socializing because of possibly some medical issues, difficulty understanding conversations, or other issues. And they often didn't have the desired amount of contact with people they felt close to or with their friends or relatives. Next slide, please. The most striking number on this slide that came out of the survey is that 14% in the middle. So the question asked the participants if in the past 2 weeks they'd had any face-to-face time, telephone, or written contact with family members or friends, and 14% had none in the 2 weeks before they came into our into the clinic or wherever they took that survey. And the other most striking number is that 61% on the right that scored as high risk on the scale that the UW put out there. So isolation was a really big issue for Washington State, just based on this tiny sample, but that was even before COVID. Next slide, please. So the second prompt to childcare that I'll jump back to in our friends category is our Department of Commerce grant. So we obtained that grant last summer, and we're in the middle of it now. We have completed the needs assessment for the county. Some of you may have seen the monkey survey come by. We were able to survey 311 people, and this slide shows 218 of those folks answered the question on the ease of finding childcare. And you'll see that it's probably no surprise to any of you who have heard me speak before, but 33% found it very difficult and 39% found it difficult. So most people are struggling to find childcare. The rest of our needs assessment was done through key informant interviews and focus groups. We got a lot of data and we're pulling that all together. We've pulled together a team to continue working on this. We have two consultants who will help us work on finding partners to help develop more childcare and also identify some potential sites that that partner could then take on. So our goal for this is really to create a package to hand off to a childcare expert to, at the end of this summer, say, yes, we're ready to go ahead and increase the childcare in this county, and we want to make it as easy as possible for them. We'll have a feasibility study done by then as well, and so we're excited with all the work that's ahead of us for that. Next slide, please. And then the last thing, this is falls under our first 1,000 days, so that time between conception and 2 years of life when a lot of our health is programmed. One of the projects that we have coming up is through a group called Upstream. They're a nonprofit that has worked across the country and is now in Washington. They have funding to come in and help primary care clinics and hospitals improve access to contraception so that pregnancies are planned and come at a time that works for the family, which is usually the best for the child that comes out of that pregnancy. They've done a lot of work in Delaware, and so the chart you see on there showed that since the start of their work, they were able to decrease unintended pregnancies by 25% across all of Delaware. So they will be starting their work with us probably this summer, and there will be some great training opportunities for our staff and our providers and some resource development as well. So we're really excited about that. Next slide, please. Back to you, Dania.
And the last thing that I'll say about the isolation piece before I jump into food really briefly is that Molly also wrote and got another one of the Department of Health grants that are very small planning grants. Those are the monies that supported the original housing work, the participatory planning and budgeting work that we did with Brennan School District, and last year helped support the food pantry work. And this new grant is going to be looking at the feasibility and implementation, what it would take to sort of look at something like a silver line. That is a model where it's essentially a phone number that people can call if they're feeling isolated and talk to someone on the other end for a period of time and just sort of chat with them. It was something that I had talked about, I think, the first time I presented to you in January of 2017 when I said I tried to get myself a landline to start one by myself, but that felt really weird. And so now we actually have funding to do it under the hospital and see what it would take and what partners we could work with. And so that'll be cool to bring that back 4 years later. So in regards to food, Tina has done an amazing job giving out food over the last year. The funding them in 2020 came from a multitude of resources. So as I said, the Washington State Department of Health funded Our employees supported a lot of the free pantry work. The Jefferson County Community Foundation also gave us funding, and then Sunrise Rotary supported our food bags through the Family Birth Center and also for our inpatients with COVID. I wanted to take a poll of the commissioners to make this a little bit more interactive here, but the way that you sort of track how much food you're giving out is typically in pounds, which is interesting. And so in 9 months of 2020, I would like to hear guesses on how many pounds of food we moved through the hospital and clinics.
200.
I heard 200.
A ton.
Anyone else? Any guesses?
2 tons.
2 tons.
I can say 5,000 pounds.
Sorry, what?
5,000.
All right. A little bit less than that, but we did move 2,500 pounds, so 2,500 pounds of food that we handed out either through our emergency room. The clinics handed out tons and tons of bags of food out. And so I think that is a huge step for only 9 months in 2020. It's almost hard to keep it on the shelves at this point, it feels good to be able to do something about that, but to think more long-term for our community. We clearly have a food insecurity problem here that we need to be really thinking about. In the rest of the food world, we are also continuing our vegetable prescription program partnership with the farmers market. So we're doing sort of reinvigoration of that work with a clinic champion to get those into the hands of kiddos for their VegRx prescriptions. And then also we're continuing our CSA partnerships with the local farmers here as well, where they pick them up right outside the front door for our employees. Next slide. All right, and then we're going to go into equity. And I try to change it up a little bit every time I speak to you about this. It's an incredibly important topic. I don't want to lose momentum. At the same time, I also don't want it to become sort of just business as usual. I want to keep discussing it in new and different ways. Quick reminder on our IHI projects. Next slide, please. So through the IHI learning cohort, we had chosen two main projects. One was clinical, one was not. Really, the education piece around our employees was the big one that is being led through Caitlin and her department. And the other piece was around data and analytics and really ensuring that we understand the way that we are giving care in an equitable way. That is more of our clinical side. We could have chosen a number of quality metrics that we wanted to address, but we decided, well, why don't we focus on the data and analytics first, and then that'll sort of lead us to what clinical projects we really, really want to focus on. And so again, this is sort of the big picture, two projects for IHI. Obviously, we're doing a ton more. We are working with Chris Harris, who is now a one-day-a-week Population Health Department member who works on a number of equity initiatives, but these were the two big projects out of the IHI. Next slide. And then, as I said last month, you know, we had these really nicely laid plans. I wanted to be super intentional about the projects that we're going to be doing and start at the very beginning. And then all of a sudden, there was sort of this implementation science opportunity here with the COVID-19 vaccine. And so really looking at the way that we distributed the COVID-19 vaccine, as I'm calling equity implementation in progress. And so essentially learning how we could do better on equity while we were running these vaccine clinics that have taken up a significant portion of a lot of our times to get them out the door. And so as we sort of thought through, what does equity look like in regards to the COVID-19 vaccine? It started a lot with the data. It also started with some of the materials that we had. Next slide, please. And also the partnerships that we were making. So I am hopeful that for those of you who did get your COVID-19 vaccine here, you got this really beautiful, and if you can see me, I'm holding the bumper sticker that says We Heart Immunity. It says Jefferson Healthcare in it. One of the things that we decided to do was to have that made also in Spanish so that our Spanish-speaking patients could have one as well that represented their first language. And so we had that made on the left-hand side, and we hand that out to individuals who want it. We made contact with a number of community groups that we have been working with on this, the Jefferson County Immigration Rights Advocates, JICIRA, who are an amazing group of people that have really been helpful, especially reaching the immigrant and specifically Spanish-speaking population. the Jefferson County Anti-Racist Fund, who also have been a really interesting group that I had not been aware of before. And they have been engaged and are interested in this work as well. There were two different ESL groups. One was based in Jefferson County. The other one was run through Peninsula College. They have both been at the table talking to us about how to get the word out to their students primarily and their students' families to make sure that they know that they can come here, get the COVID vaccine, that everyone is welcome. We worked to get the language line available out in the vaccine shed, which was not available before, to make sure that we were able to speak with people in their native tongue moving forward. We had individuals go to the senior food bank to sign people up there. And so also looking at equities outside of race and ethnicity, but also socioeconomic status. We have been working with the Catholic Church to get people there as well, which was an interesting conversation. And this came out of both our conversations with Jasira as well as the Catholic Church, was they said that the way to move the needle in their population specifically, the thing that really did it for them is they watched a video. So the Archbishop in Seattle took a video of himself getting the COVID-19 vaccine. And that was the thing that really moved everyone. And so we haven't been able to get a video like that, but we did have our own Dr. Harris, next slide, please, do a video in Spanish, and this is just a screenshot of him, and I tried to get the most neutral looking screenshot, but he did it's about a minute and a half long video in Spanish talking about the vaccine. They could get it here, it's safe, everyone is welcome regardless of citizenship, and they actually used WhatsApp, which is an app that people use similar to texting, to send it out to over 100 families to get them signed up. So that was super cool. We actually did not put the Dr. David Harris Jefferson Healthcare there at the bottom. Jasira took it upon themselves to edit our video and send it back to us and said, this is better, please upload this one instead, which was super fun. But to have them really involved in that conversation and involved in what their group wanted and what would make them feel comfortable about coming here felt really good. Next slide, please. So these are numbers that we look at regularly, that I especially look at regularly. Here we can see vaccination rates. And so this is of the total population, either white or BIPOC and Latinx. How many of them have been vaccinated. So this looks in January, February, and then March as of Monday. And so what I'm really looking for here is closing that gap. The dark blue is white and the red is the BIPOC Latinx. Closing that gap in between the white and the BIPOC Latinx. And so making that more equal in terms of vaccination rates. We saw the gap grow a little bit from January to February. You can see that the vaccination rates for whites went up more than they did for BIPOC Latinx. However, we were able to close that gap a little bit in March, and again, it's not complete. And so it was really, we've been talking about this work for a long time. It took a while to help identify some of these community partners and really sort of get our work really moving in regards to the language line, having the Spanish bumper sticker, having Dr. Harris's video. And so we were able to close that gap a little bit, and I'm hoping that over time we will continue to see that gap close as well. Next slide, please. I wanted to take a minute just to talk about current events too. As I'm sure everyone has been watching the news, there has been a lot of violence against the AAPI community, Asian American and Pacific Islander community. On the right-hand side of your screen, you will see a statement that we put out on our Instagram social media page last week after the shootings in Atlanta. And so being very vocal and verbal in response to these acts of hatred. There's a group that comes out of California State University. It's the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism, which is quite a mouthful, but also it just is an incredibly important topic that they have been tracking for a very long time. They've been looking at hate crimes, and the dark blue is 2019 and the red is 2020. All hate crimes, so total number of hate crimes actually went down. In 2019, there was 1,877, and in 2020, there was 1,773. These are only in the top 18 largest cities in the United States. So top 18 cities in the United States, biggest cities, Seattle is one of those cities. That's where these data are pulled from. It's also only hate crimes that are actually reported to the police. And as we know, the majority of hate crimes are not reported at all. So this is a massive undercount of what actually is happening. But the point is that in those 18 cities, total number of hate crimes decreased from 2019 to 2020 by 6%. Anti-Asian hate crimes during that same time frame increased by 145%. It went from 49 in 2019 to 120 in 2020, which is a massive increase. And I'm sure as you're watching the news, this isn't surprising. It's shocking and horrific, but it is something that we are absolutely seeing in response to COVID-19, and is something that we are vocal in rejecting, essentially. And so, and I'm going to invite Mike to also step in here as well, but we worked on some language in regards to a statement for how we were going to respond to this, and it's on the next slide, Brittany, if you don't mind. And I don't need to read this out loud for you, but I can give everyone a moment. And then maybe Mike, if you want to say a few words or whatever feels comfortable.
Well, sure. I will support this work while the commissioners are reading this. As you are aware, we have stepped into this equity work in a real and significant way. And it is our intention, as Dunya mentioned, to not just be avoid being racist in our practices, but working on what it means to be actively anti-racist, actively inclusive, actively equity and equality driven. What we are learning in our work is that there is a lot of foundation building that needs to occur before you can do this work in a genuine and I think enduring way. We have started on that journey. And as outrageous and horrific as these events are, they do provide an opportunity for Jefferson Healthcare to stand up, use our voice, and other resources to support those who are being marginalized and continue to promote equity.
Thanks, Mike. And that is actually how we wanted to end our presentation today and open it up for questions, comments, discussion.
Comments, questions? Looks like real progress is being made. This is wonderful. I think my heartfelt thanks to Molly and to Dunya for all their hard work. And I know you have a team behind you too that's working really hard. Congratulations and great on the grant again too.
Yeah, I wanna second that. When I joined the board, that was about the time that different hospitals and hospital districts were looking at getting more involved in population health. And I'm just blown away by how much commitment the staff has made to this. And hopefully the staff feels that you're getting enough board support to do this. And it's just remarkable what this small institution is able to do for this important issue in our community. I'd love to get a copy of the slides so that I can share them with other people. So that would be lovely if you could make those available to us. And then finally, I guess my question is, what more can the board do to either support the population work or, in particular, to support this new horrific problem, growing problem of racist violence in this country? So Is there something that the board could or should do at this point to continue to promote this good work?
I think the board has been incredibly supportive of all of this. I think this is one of the reasons why we have been so successful in making this pretty much, it's not commonplace, but like this is just what we do now at Jefferson Healthcare is we do population health. And of course, I'm saying that as the director of population health. And so part of it is job security that I hope we continue to do it. But this was only a smattering of the projects that we've been working on this past year. We are still continuing to do baby boxes. I've participated in transportation conversations, broadband. So we do touch a lot of things and we really appreciate the board's support in that. And I'm sorry, I think Mike or Jill, one of you was going to speak as well.
Go ahead, Jill.
I think Mike has been instrumental in this as well. He has created an umbrella and created the method for this to all happen. And thank you, Mike. You actually walk the walk, and that's important.
Thank you.
Anything else? Any other comments, questions?
I see a hand from Mari.
I can hear her in the background.
Mari, we're not hearing you.
I can hear you. I'm absolutely staggered that there are 25,000 pounds of food distributed last year through the little free pantries and other methods. And I'm delighted that my Rotary Club, Sunrise Rotary, has been able to help support that as well as help support the, through the foundation, support the childcare issue. It is totally amazing that there is so much need in our county where there is quite a lot of wealth and there is such an, if you like, an underbody of people who are suffering. And the more we can do to equalize and support and help these people, the better. So I'm really, I'm absolutely staggered that there was not much food was needed and used, thank goodness. And as someone who grew up in a food, obviously scarce, but difficult circumstances, my widowed mother had to work full time and my older brother and myself were often we were fed, but my mother wasn't because of poverty. And even though she grew vegetables and kept chicken and geese and ducks and rabbits for the table, which she sold in order to make some money, I can relate to this. And I'm just so thankful that we were able to do this for our community members.
I would like to make one other comment about the equity work, that there were as many as seven of us from Jefferson Healthcare who participated in a two-day workshop with the Institute for Healthcare Improvement last week. And it really was a very incredible experience to spend time with people from all over the country doing this work. And Jefferson Healthcare was very well represented, and Dunya and Molly did a great job of presenting some of the work that we're doing here at Jefferson Healthcare for this large group of people who are in our cohort for this equity work. So again, I just want to commend the staff for being there, and Mike for supporting the staff's being there. And Mike was there as well. So it was a very positive experience. And it's a privilege to work with the staff on those issues.
I have a question for Dr. Parker and Dunya regarding childcare. Does it look like there's any way that we can make this continue to go so that people in our community can have better access to childcare after the initial money runs out.
Yeah, Molly, you got that figured out yet, Molly?
Yeah, no problem. No, I'm really hopeful. I think this grant is going to tee up the whole process for an organization to take it and run. I think we also are lucky in our timing because the state is revising their fee scales for families because this is an issue all the way across the country, but the state has really recognized that. So there's some state action that will really help childcare groups be more viable over time, and possibly some infrastructure funding that may be coming that we might be able to apply for down the road as well. So it's a good time to be working on this. It's great that we're ready to go. So I'm excited too. And I just wanted to clarify, it's 2,500 pounds of food, just so that we're all on the same page.
Yeah, I think Molly has been working on this probably informally at least 10 years, because as long as I have been here, Molly's been an advocate for higher quality, improved access to childcare, and certainly formally the last 4 or 5 years. And in that time, we've have done internal studies, set up task forces, made application for grants, got grants, established a lot of data, subjective and objective, about the state of childcare in our community, which is very important. In addition to that, we have been reaching out and cultivating friendships with other parties who have an interest or an expertise in this. And I think the model that is most interesting, and actually they were co-applicants on the grant that we received and will likely be co-applicants in future grants, Peninsula College and the YMCA. So the really exciting thing is that Peninsula College has early childhood development program, and in Port Angeles, they have excellent sustainable childcare that's offered as part of that program. So students participate in it, gathering those skills, and Peninsula College employees and other surrounding area employees use it for childcare. And it's a wonderful model. Dunya and Molly went out and visited different childcare centers and thought, boy, this would be fabulous. Well, where we are aiming is to set up something similar here. And we've had several meetings with representatives from Peninsula College and Wendy Burt from the YMCA, who is terrific. And we sort of have this shared mental model of what this could look like. An immediate increase in high quality childcare availability, a process that develops highly trained childcare employees, and with the couple of different partners, probably a high likelihood of the continued demand for those services. So we have been slowly building up to this point and are in really great shape now that representatives from, Patty Murray's office and Derek Kilmer's office, and even at the state level, we have been told that there will be opportunities to make grant requests for projects just like this. So, it's still a moonshot, but I like our chances because of the work that Molly has led and we have done up to this point. And it would be so cool and so well received.
That's for sure. By the whole community.
Yeah.
Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you for that presentation. It's certainly uplifting, and we appreciate all the work that you're doing on it. So at this time, then, we will go ahead and take a little early recess, and we will come back at 3:30 to begin.
Can I say something before we break?
Pardon me?
Can I say something before we break? I had my hand up.
Sure. I'm sorry. I didn't see it.
I had it up twice. Anyway, I just want to say it was a great report, and I really want to thank Molly and Dunya and Mike for their leadership and for all the hard work that has gone on to be able to give such a positive report. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bruce.
Okay, then with that, we will see you in a few minutes at 3:30. Thank you, everybody. Go ahead and restart the business section of the meeting. Are you ready, Brittany?
We are indeed. I hit record.
Okay, thank you. So welcome back to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, March 24th, 2021. And we will now begin the business portion of our meeting. And before we go any further, I was derelict in my duty and forgot to ask for an approval of the agenda. So may I have such an approval from the board?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
Discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All right. It is approved unanimously. Thank you. So now it gives me great pleasure to do one of the most heartwarming things that we have in our business meeting quarterly. And Mike, would you like to do the introductions for our team employee and provider of the quarter? I think Kate Lynn will probably do it, but Mike?
Yeah. Well, I will happily turn the presentation over to Caitlin. So, Caitlin, you are up.
Thank you. This is also one of my favorite things we get to do. Rachel, I think you are on the phone. If you wouldn't mind turning your camera on, it's always fun to do this and embarrass the folks at the same time. So, Rachel actually is our employee of the quarter, and she's from our clinical informatics team. Rachel's a support tech, and she's gone far and beyond this role and how she's helped the COVID vaccine team operationalize their scheduling of thousands of patients. For those of you that are familiar, think the terms JOT to EPIC. To receive their vaccine, she's constantly optimizing operations, and she's proved to be an exceptional asset to other teams. In addition to her work on the vaccine team, Rachel continues to bring clinical informatics help to all employees. So please join me in congratulating Rachel. I love that. And up next, I will ask the same thing of Dr. Eirich. If you can turn your camera on, that would be great. Oops, I think they were out of order. Do you mind giving me provider of the quarter? Perfect. Thank you. So Dr. Eirich brings a deep commitment to community in his work, and he works hard to keep up on everything new to emergency medicine. In service to our most vulnerable populations, he shows exceptional understanding of the resources available to him on the peninsula and is able to guide patients toward them. One of the big projects that Dr. Eirich has been working on as point of care ultrasound, where he not only is training our current staff members and physicians on how to use point of care ultrasound, but he's also doing quality checks as well. So we are very excited to thank him and congratulate our provider of the quarter, Dr. Eirich from the emergency department.
Well done, Chance.
And then if you wouldn't mind going back to the last slide, Brittany, to our COVID vaccine team. This team has spent exhaustive hours coordinating, planning, and leading efforts to administer vaccines for our staff, our patients, and our entire community. all while continuing our commitment to health equity and barrier reductions for all community members. This nomination actually came from SLG, but we have a few members of our team that we're congratulating through this, and they did not nominate themselves, I promise. But please join me in congratulating Rachel, Dr. Steve Butterfield, Dunya Foe, Jamie Hubler, Dr. Joe Mattern, Jesse Michaels, Susie Wright, Alyssa Rodriguez, Jen Wharton, and Amy Yaley. Congratulations and thank you to the COVID vaccine team. And again, quickly, if you can, turn your cameras on so we can see your faces. Give a quick wave and thank you to you all.
Thank you to everyone. What, congratulations, all of you. Takes a village and a lot of leaders in there to make things happen, and we appreciate you all. Thank you. Anything else that the board would like to comment?
Well-deserved rewards.
Absolutely.
Yes, grateful thank you on behalf of our community.
Okay.
And just a note for the COVID vaccine team, if you have not seen it, the visitor board actually thanks them specifically. So if you haven't had a chance, please drive by and see a thank you to the COVID vaccine team from Jefferson Healthcare.
Hey. I did notice that. That was excellent.
Yes. Well deserved.
And if I could also add that in the leader today, there is a full page thank you to all of the providers at Jefferson Healthcare, full page with pictures of, I haven't even counted them. And it says, in a year unlike any other, our providers offered COVID-19 care and all other forms of care. They covered our whole health right here at home. Happy Doctors' Day, Jefferson Healthcare. So,
yes, happy Doctors' Day is the truth. That's great. Thank you. Anybody else? All right, then we will go on to another favorite, and that is the patient story with Tina Toner, our chief nursing officer.
Hi, good afternoon. So I have a fun patient story today and actually more recognition for an important team in our hospital. So you can go to the next slide, Brittany. We have all heard the saying that the patient experience doesn't end until the bill arrives, but actually there can be a final piece, and that's when a patient receives the bill and begins worrying about how they will pay for it. And for many people, they worry as much about their bill as they do about their health. And our financial counselors work tirelessly to assist patients, to reassure them, and often are a vital link to ensuring that they continue to receive the care that is needed when finances are of concern. So for today's patient story, I want to share a thank you we received recently about our financial aid department. And the note read, this financial aid department has been caring, respectful, cheerful, competent, and very helpful, even when having very busy schedules. They are wonderful people. Since my geographical area doesn't accept computer service well and the mail is slow, I can even pick up my bill at the hospital. Justin, Winky, and Melissa are among the best people. And when the patient advocates brought me this thank you, I was touched that someone would have such a positive experience with the billing piece of their care that they would write a thank you. And actually, I learned that it's not uncommon at all. And specifically, the individualized and caring work that Melissa, Justin, and Winky do is often recognized by our patients as they provide support at such an important time in our patients' lives. So thank you to our financial counselors for the important role that they play in our patient stories.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for the good stories. And thank you to the three financial counselors. That is a very important role. I'm sure that they have a lot more wishes out there that are letters that they receive. Thank you. Any other comments from the board? Okay, then we will move on to thank you again, Tina. And we will now address the minutes of the February 24th regular session and the March 3rd special session minutes. Is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? All right. Motion required approval. Appointments and reappointments. Motion to approve, please.
Second.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Sounds like we're getting some echo, right? I think I heard that that was unanimous. Correct me if I'm wrong. Okay.
Correct.
Thank you. Okay, we will move to the financial report. And it looked on my agenda, it said Mike is going to present this. Is that correct, Mike?
That's correct, yes. So, first slide, Brittany. So February was a disaster for several reasons, and I'm going to start with volumes. The attachment that you're looking at now, you are familiar with. Red means under budget, green means over budget. The being, you'll note that there is a this report indicates we had more adjusted patient days than budgeted. That we believe that there is a we are doing the calculation correctly, but the calculation that accounts adjusted patient days is no longer serving a useful purpose. just by what we used to use it as kind of this total basket collection of all things that we do allocated by sort of relative value unit as by virtue of revenue each service unit of service produced, and that would allow us to be able to count total joint replacements along with blood tests, and it was indicative of it was a good index of overall volume. It clearly isn't any longer because it's hard to believe we could be 26% above budget in adjusted patient days and be off our all things inpatient by over 30%. So again, the calculation is correct. I just think we need to look at how the factors that go into the calculation to see if we can make it more useful. Inpatient and ED volumes were way off. In a moment, I will show you the revenue report, and our inpatient revenue was off by 50%, which I have never seen before. The emergency department continues to be significantly off, not only in volumes, but in revenue, which we are learning is not an unusual thing for hospitals during COVID. The challenging thing is there's pretty much nearly a fixed amount of expenses that go into the emergency department. There's some ability to flex staff, but as I frequently tell people when they are point out to me how high emergency department bills are, I will tell them that, well, you're not only paying for that one day this year that you use the emergency department, you're paying for the 364 days that you may have needed it, it had something occurred. So lots of fixed expenses, and when patients don't show up, not a good thing. Next slide, please. So this is the operating statement. Expenses were over budget, I think due to a slow start in managing labor hours and the continuation of fairly significant COVID-related expenses, which tend to show up whether patients do or not. If you think about it, we have been adding layers of COVID response services for the last 12 months. And when we add a layer on, like the testing station or the temperature check station or the res clinic or the 1-800 line and now the vaccination clinic, when we add one, we don't remove one. So we are now at this February anyway, represented this accumulation of all of the layers of COVID-related expenses, all of them under reimbursed, several of them completely unreimbursed, that add up to a significant expense. Doing what we need to do in order to meet the COVID service needs of our community and to keep our patients safe, but a huge layer of costs that doesn't necessarily correlate to a stream of reimbursement.
Excuse me, Mike, can I interrupt for just one sec?
Sure.
There's a very persistent clicking sound coming through, and I think it's from Mari's computer. If you could mute, then it might go away. Mari, are you there?
I am here. But I don't know that I will mute. But
thank you.
Okay. So we spoke of volumes being down, which translates to our lower gross patient service revenue. And we did miss that number by $1.3 million. Or 6%, but you will note that our total operating revenue, we missed by 16%. And let me tell you how that works. And this is somewhat concerning. I'm gonna use one of Hillary's fancy financial jargon terms when I say there's something wacky going on with our revenue adjustments or contractual allowances. And as you know, this is the monthly calculation that estimates the difference between what you bill from what you end up receiving. It's a very complicated calculation, tends to get distorted during periods of wide volume, payer mix, and bad debt variation, which we are seeing all three right now. And it's difficult to calculate. Even in the best of circumstances, you're basically looking at all of these different variables that are increasing and decreasing, and trying to determine a composite of what the likely amount of cash will come in 45 to 50 days based on the bills that you sent out today. In the past, years ago, we used to use 50% as a rough estimate for our revenue adjustments. So for every dollar we billed, we get to spend about 50 cents. And Hillary used that for several years. You know, it was just sort of kind of a thumbnail to help us understand, well, here's how that revenue translates to what we will see. And again, that was a very easy interpretation of a complicated, but for the most part, stable contractual allocation or revenue adjustment situation. A few years ago, it increased to 52%. So we began seeing 48 cents per billed dollar based on more public payers and less commercial payers. This year, taking into account the continuation of this trend, we budgeted about 54%, so in other words, 46 cents on the dollar. In February, our revenue adjustments, including charity care, which I include as a revenue adjustment, were 59%. So what we were expecting to receive, 46 cents on the dollar, I should say, that's what we budgeted. According to our revenue adjustment calculation, we believe we will see 41 cents on the dollar. Jim and I talked and agreed that it's not uncommon to see some distortion at the beginning of the year with respect to contractual allowances or revenue adjustments. This is the number that was spit out, and we are using it. But to give you some perspective of what does the difference between 46 cents return versus 41% return over the course of the year with a $270 million operation, and the answer is $11 million. So if we are going to be watching the revenue adjustments and charity care adjustments very closely the next few months to see if this bouncing around, and again, it's based on all of these factors that go into calculating revenue adjustments. It is the calculation is correct. There is just the assumptions that goes into the calculation based on fewer data points rather than lots of data points creates variability in the number that's spit out.
I have one question. Do you think that at the start of the year, if this would be much factor that maybe a lot of people are, having to satisfy their deductible and that's slower coming in than the insurance payments, and so it might just lag behind a bit?
Well, that's possible. We try to take a calculation included in the revenue adjustment formula is to calculate for that, and what percentage we will see and when. It's really this incredibly complex calculation, but I think that your point is spot on in. When you are seeing trends like that, that may be just seasonal. They tend to maybe over report the potential impact. So the purpose in talking about this one, I wanted to point out to you, I've never seen a revenue adjustment this large in a month. There's no question in my mind that it is correct based on the work that our finance team did. It is just reflective of a bunch of variables that I think will stabilize and change, and then over the course of the next 3 to 6 to 9 months will drift up to something probably short or south of 46%, but above 41%, because it's a huge deal. It's like this devaluation of a Jefferson Healthcare dollar, and unfortunately there is no devaluation of our expense dollars. So if by virtue of more Medicare patients, more Medicaid patients, and what we are seeing, more commercial insured co-payments not being paid, so therefore drifting into bad debt, that is going to be something we'll have to deal with. I mean, it's an external factor, right? It's not something that you can improve operations, or you really can't make that up by growing business. But it's reflective of a change in sort of the local healthcare economic environment that we need to be very mindful of.
Mike, is this prevalent throughout the state or throughout the country? Do you know? Is this a result of a lot of people who have lost their jobs because of COVID, for example?
Yeah, it's probably yes, that you probably are seeing hospitals across the country showing a deterioration of commercial insurance. We were starting at such a low rate to begin with. It's not uncommon to see 35-40% commercially insured, 60% Medicare, Medicaid, and you know we're probably just below 80% now. And you know, as I've explained to you, with the way critical access hospitals get paid, there is probably a mark where too much of our business that's at or below our costs will have serious implications for some of the outreach work that we do.
Thank you.
I recall, Mike, you've been warning about the trend of our mix of patients and how they are covered with or without insurance. You've been warning about that for as long as I've been on the board.
Yeah, and actually, it was Vic Dirksen used to wring his hands about it when folks used to ask Vic what was the greatest threat to the hospital. Vic said the closure of the mill, because in his estimation that would reduce the percentage of commercially insured down to a level that he thought would be problematic. So it's a thing that I think we need to be mindful of. And you know, and I think that as we advocate in Olympia and Washington, D.C., advocate strongly for universal coverage, which I completely endorse and believe in, we also need to be mindful about what that coverage looks like, and that the reimbursement for services for all members of our community cover our costs, which I think is important.
Mike, does the increase in the timeline and requirements for the Affordable Care Act, is that going to have any favorable impact on us, do you think?
Well, interestingly, where we are, perhaps. I mean, I think that the good news is that we can, like we did 4 or 5 years ago, steer people who qualify for enhanced Medicaid through the ACA, but haven't found their way to sign up for it and are seeking care, because those would be patients that were taken care of. That qualify for charity care, and now there would be some reimbursement. The downside to it is that it sort of perpetuates this trend, and that Medicaid pays below our eligible costs, and there's a lot of services that we provide here that aren't eligible costs. So 1 month a trend does not make, but this was really alarming to me when I saw you bill $21 million and you take home less than, or, you know, 8.9. I scratched my head and say, wow, I haven't seen that before. And then the second quick snapshot is, you know, our gross patient service revenue was significantly below budget. It was 6% below what we thought it would be, but the revenue adjustments were 2% above budget. And that should, under normal circumstances and all things being equal, that should not happen, right? Because it's a percentage that those numbers run in tandem. But this reflects a difference in payer mix and an activity within those payer mixes that we had to make an adjustment for. So we're going to be watching this carefully and seeing if interventions later on in the year need to occur. There were also some things in February. We were reasonably busy in January, and then we slipped into February, and for factors that I can explain to you in the rearview mirror, but you never see coming. We were really, really, really slow. The inpatient side of the house got really slow, and as did other areas. And it's hard to manage labor at a rate that's equivalent with really low census. And manage labor is administrator speak for asking employees to take convenience time, and no one wants that. So when patients don't show up, it kind of sucks to run a hospital, because the revenue doesn't show up. You have to continuously be asking people their patients aren't here, we don't need you, and it's no fun. And then when you add on hundreds of thousands of dollars of COVID-related services, it just sort of turns a challenging situation into a really ugly one. And that's February. We lost $1.6 million. It was a brutal month.
It looks like Mari has her hand up. Mari, do you have a question?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Mari?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So I was wondering, are we still not trying to send people to collections who have been able to pay but have not paid the bad debt issue?
Yeah, we haven't changed our the policy that we instituted last March of sending people to collections, and I think there's a little bit of moral hazard going on, because we are seeing a lack of payment in areas that we haven't seen it in the past, where you typically don't see it in the cohort of commercially insured. So I think we all agree there is benefit in that policy, but the way a community hospital works is those who have the means to pay for care need to pay in order for the community to take care of those who don't have the means. And I think the trick is where you draw that line. And we will probably revisit that, because I don't think anyone would argue that someone who has the ability to pay their bill should not. It's just a matter of how do you set a system up that doesn't catch people who don't have the ability to pay their bill. And that's as tricky as it sounds.
Yes, thank you, Mike.
Okay, next slide, please. So here's relatively good news. The cash number is hanging in there. The green line represents the cash that includes the advanced payment. There were whispers back in DC that maybe a portion of the advanced payment debt would be forgiven. And so we were hopeful that that would be the case, but it did not get included in the $1.9 trillion Recovery Act. Hard to imagine that there's needs, $1.9 trillion worth of needs that are more important than that, but I guess that's the case. So the more important line, given we'll have to pay the 52 days back, is 110 days. And you know, that's not a bad place to be when you've kind of been stumbling along with operations for probably the last 6 months. You know, we really haven't re-hit our stride yet. Next slide, please.
Mike, could you remind me how much that was?
Oh, gosh, what was it? I've forgotten, Case. I'll get that to you.
Great.
It's never really seemed real to me. I had to pay it back, you know, so I didn't want to know. Hillary was loath to even tell me how much it was because she was certain we would have to pay it back. But I will share that with the entire board.
All right, thanks.
This is the board financial report. And last slide. And this is March, and what makes our situation a little bit better is we recognized that we were in a little bit of trouble about halfway into February, just in terms of the low volumes and low patient activity. We began implementing expense control measures at that time, and they, as Mari can probably attest, it takes a little while to get to modify schedules and to get into a mode of 9 to 11 patients as opposed to 17 and 18. But now we are pretty focused on that work, and I think we were doing a good job. And in addition, March volumes, the first couple of weeks were really busy, have tapered off a little bit. And we think we will come in right about at budget, maybe a little bit above. So an interesting example of you know, all that revenue adjustment stuff I was talking about. If you were and why it is, you know, so relevant to decisions that we're going to have to make going down the road, if you were to apply what we budgeted for this year to March, $31 million of projected hospital-based charges would result in $14.3 million. If you were to apply the adjusted revenue adjustment based on all of these trends that we believe we are seeing, that 14.3 number shrinks to $12,750,000. Just by virtue, not that doesn't relate at all to how well we're running the hospital or the patients that are coming in or our market share. It's just a function of the type of insurance and the payment behaviors of insurers and our patients having changed. So my hope is that going forward, this will stabilize and we'll have a better understanding. But I did feel, well, I couldn't really explain to you what happened in February without addressing that. And so I attempted to. The last thing I want to say is Jim and his team, who are responsible for coming up with the revenue adjustment number, they are spot on. It's largely formulaic, and then they're the wisdom of Jim and Sasha and all of the folks in finance. You'll sort of massage it, but the number on this operating statement is the number that is what it should be. It's accurate. I don't mean to at all suggest that it's not accurate. It just is the methodology of us determining that might include some distortion, and we've all agreed that we're going to watch it going forward to see if that distortion stabilizes and the overall impact that may have on expense decisions. So I figure a hospital CEO doesn't get too many opportunities to share with his board we lost $1.6 million in a month. So I guess it's kind of like a cat has nine lives. How many million and a half losses do I have?
So are you down to eight now?
Yeah, all right.
No.
We're on it, and we'll figure this out because we always do. And a large part of this will be growing volumes. So we're pretty focused on that, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later in my presentation. But that concludes my finance presentation.
Thank you, Mike. I feel like we're in the best possible hands. I mean, this is an unprecedented time, and I'm just glad you're at the helm.
Yeah, thanks.
Any questions from the board?
Likewise, and I'm glad that you stood up so many brownie points that we have confidence in them.
Absolutely. I'm just surprised we haven't seen numbers like that before, Mike. No, I mean, considering all the extra expenses and everything that's gone on with COVID, it's.
Yeah, it just goes to show you when we've sort of created this comprehensive high level of and number of service organization, and when patients don't show up, yikes. So we're pretty focused on solving this on the revenue side.
Why do you think people aren't showing up?
February it may not surprise you to learn, we have talked a lot about this. If you think about what was going on in February, we got our first couple of rounds of shots in the middle of December, I think we got like 4,000 shots and pretty much knocked out the healthcare workers and first responders. And that took us into about the middle of January. Well, we didn't get vaccine for an entire month. So we speculate that by virtue of us being a high Medicare organization, that means most of our patients are 65 and above. I think patients were thinking, certainly for discretionary care, I'm you know, my number is going to be called here pretty soon for my vaccine. My hip is hurting, but I've held off this long. I think I'm going to wait until I get my two shots before I go in and go to a hospital. That makes as much sense to me as anything else. And, you know, February, we were just sort of coming off kind of a scary time. That numbers have dropped precipitously now, but boy, from about a November to February, it was frightening. So I think that had something to do for the discretionary calls. Yeah, plus we do a 12-month budget, and February is a 28-day month, so we always get bit a little bit by this. And I think it's just the things that we never fully understand. I may, you know, try to explain them, but it's just kind of the whims of community seeking care. So if it's just one bad month, I don't get too concerned about it. And things did bounce back in February, or excuse me, March. So we'll continue to monitor. But it socks a punch when you're that far off of your budgeted revenues. There's no question about it. And really, everybody feels it. Everybody feels it. It's truly no fun. Or let me say this differently. It's a hell of a lot more fun to be grappling with growth issues than walking around the shop and asking people to go home early. That just is no one's idea of building engagement.
Thank you, Mike.
Yep.
All right. Any other questions, comments from the board? Okay, then thanks again, Mike, and then we'll hear your administrative report after our quality report from Brandy Manuel, our Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer. Brandy?
Hey. Hi. Thank you for letting me talk a little bit about my favorite subject. So my report is actually going to be a little bit boring this month, which I think is okay. Generally, things looked pretty good in February and rounding out the fourth quarter. You'll notice that we are yellow on our compliance with core measures. A couple of areas where we're not quite leading the pack and have some opportunity are in our transfer times for our cardiac patients out of the emergency department, and also on our emergency department throughput time. So we'll be working on that. I've been talking with Tina and Catalina, who's been leading our emergency department work, and we've got some good plans in place, and we'll continue to take a look at that. You'll also notice that under zero incidents of workplace violence is our goal. That one is an uncharacteristic salmon color. We had two instances of workplace violence reported in the month of February. One was an animal bite to the leg of an employee. Didn't break the skin, but not fun to get nipped at by an animal that isn't your own. And then the second was an assault from a patient to an employee. Again, they struck out at an employee, but there was not any harm reported from it. So it was more of a near miss, but still not within our goal of zero events. Otherwise, if we peel back the layer and kind of look underneath those colors, this is what we see. So in general, things are looking good. There's not a lot of action to report. You'll see we had really no change in our adverse drug events, which is good because we've been at zero. So continuing to stay there is our goal. Our inpatient days of therapy decreased last month, which is good. And our falls with injury, again, stayed consistently low. Our ambulatory antibiotic stewardship program, the pilot that we had been working on, closed out. And through that, we were able to build some best practices and some reports and are continuing to work with our data team on refining those reports and making those available to our providers to continue to work on antimicrobial stewardship in the ambulatory setting. So that's pretty exciting. Zero hospital-acquired pressure ulcers to report. Again, that is our goal. And working with Lindsay and some of our amazing nurses up on the floor to take a closer look at pressure ulcer prevention up on the floor and nursing interventions, and including working with our providers and from wound therapy to think about more education, more training on just how to make sure that we're preventing our patients from getting pressure ulcers in such a high-risk population. And then in infection prevention, again, just not a lot of things to report, which is what we are aiming for. So we did not have a change in our C. diff, which is good because that was zero. And our cases of catheter-associated urinary tract infection, central line-associated bloodstream infections, and SSI, which is surgical site infections, were at zero. So all good news. Shifting over into service excellence and the words of our patients, the end of the year ended up pretty good. So we saw a dip kind of early on when COVID hit, and it changed the way that we were giving care and we were receiving our patients. And that was reflected in their comments. It was reflected in our scores a little bit. Those popped up. And in looking at the comments over the last month or so, we're really seeing those COVID comments kind of clear up. We're not seeing that as much at all. Any areas where we have opportunity for improvement, it tends to be in communication, which is what we're kind of used to seeing. But a lot of really good feedback and thinking that, you know, we like to show appreciation for our providers. It's Doctor's Day, Doctor's Month. We had a few providers who were called out by our patients, which I think is great. I also wanted to call out a few of our departments who exceeded our goal. In our strategic plan, we wanted to be top quartile. And I'm happy to share that by the end of the year, we had the women's clinic who exceeded that goal. Our dental clinic exceeded that goal. Our emergency department, all of our inpatient units, and our hospice team all exceeded that top quartile goal. So good job to all of those teams who, in a very weird year, continued to be there for our patients. And just some current projects that are going. I wanted to take a minute to call out Lindsay Dykes, who I don't know if she's on the line, but Lindsay led our reaccreditation for the sleep clinic on March 12th this month. And it's a pretty comprehensive, intense 3-year reaccreditation. And Lindsay and Jen Wharton did a beautiful job, got through it all. With great feedback in only one area of opportunity. So that's just an amazing, amazing job by them. Also, we just submitted for our last year MIPS reporting. So thanks to Dunia and our data team, particularly Sean, who spent a lot of time preparing those reports and getting those ready to go. And then lots of performance improvement work. Had the opportunity to work with Tina's teams and some of our support teams on doing a post-acute patient surge drill this week, which was really pretty fun to do, and continuing to do a lot of our patient safety work. Any questions?
Great work again. I mean, when patients do come back, boy, are they coming to the right place. We're so doing so well with our quality. Thank you. Does that conclude your report?
Sorry, I was muted. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Any questions or comments from the board? Okay. Thank you, Brandy, again.
Well done.
Mari has her hand up, Jill.
Oh, yes. Mari.
Well done.
I just said well done. It's remarkable.
All right. Thank you. Then we'll go on to Mike again, Mike Glenn, our CEO, for the administration report.
Okay, next slide, please. Next slide, please. So I wanted to give you an update on our testing activity. There was a time when we were as excited about watching the total test number grow, or more accurately, the negative test number grow, as we are now in watching the total vaccination number grow. But it is important to note that we still are doing a sizable amount of testing. Most of the testing is for pre-procedure in order to rule out COVID before patients come to the hospital for a surgical procedure. But we also continue to do symptomatic tests, and Dr. Locke reminds us the importance from a community surveillance perspective of continued testing. So it's work that we are continuing to do. Next slide. Our PPE inventory. I also remember when, you know, we would hold our breath when Kelly would announce the new numbers for PPE. And, you know, just to give you an idea of how far we've come with this, that the there was a time when the COVID surge stockpile represented about a third of our entire inventory. So in other words, we would have 30,000 procedure masks in the COVID surge stockpile, and we might have 100,000 total masks, and, you know, 4,600 N95s and maybe 15,000 total N95 masks. Well, through Kelly's good work and I think the organization just getting better at finding and using PPE, and the PPE supply chain freeing up, it really is not something that that we still monitor with great fear. We still, Kelly's a standing member of Incident Command, and every day or every meeting, Brandy calls on her, and she gives us updates on these categories, and particularly with procedure masks, because we are putting a procedure mask on everybody that comes into the hospital, so you can go through those faster than maybe an N95. But it's just a wonderful place to be, where there are no limitations on an employee using a piece of PPE. It's what the CDC, what best practice, what the Department of Health, and what the employee thinks they need to do to keep themselves safe. And we've spent a lot of time defining those, and it's just a nice spot to be in, where go where the science takes you, and what you think you need to wear to keep yourself safe. Next slide, please. This is our the COVID phone line and clinic visit volumes on the left, and the respiratory clinic volumes on the right. You can see that these numbers kind of continue to fall, which you would expect given the amount of community prevalence is falling. So that's the chart on my left. I think it's on your left too, on the computer screen. On the right is the respiratory clinic. And what we did do recently, because the office clinic visits were so low, that we have folded the RES clinic's visits into the express clinic. So we have set up a patient protocol that when those patients call the hotline and feel they need to be seen, they now just go directly, or they make an appointment for the express clinic, and we've designated time for them to show up and do that in a safe and isolated way. We spent weeks as an SLG leadership team talking about that with Joe and Steve and Tracy to make sure that the time was right and that the safety precautions were in place in the res clinic. And given the low amount of volume, I think it amounts to a couple of patients a day, it seems to make sense. Next slide, please. Primary care, you know, I've spoken a little bit about March looking better than January, and you can see that's certainly the case with primary care. Specialty care, I think in the last week, specialty care, clinics have been busier as well. Next slide, please. And these are our oncology infusion volumes and our surgical volumes. And you know, that oncology infusion, we show these, it's just sort of an interesting snapshot of sort of cancer diagnoses that happen in our community. It's really certainly not how you market cancer. Cancer care services is mostly, if you are diagnosed with breast cancer or with prostate cancer or with skin cancer, we can provide the services here. So, you know, it's certainly not something that you wish volumes grow by any means, but you do wish that fewer people leave our community. And our approach to growing cancer care services over the last few years, has been mostly having Janelle and Annie Murphy be the faces and the hands and loving hearts of our cancer program. as you know, Janelle has retired, and hopefully she's doing fun things with her grandkids. But Dr. Murphy is still up there and doing great things. And you can see our surgery cases bounced up a little bit in last week, and I think that there'll be about close to 100% the third week of March. Next slide, please. This is the emergency department and express clinic volume, and you can sort of just see the bookends of pre-COVID ED use and express clinic use and post-COVID express clinic use, particularly express clinic. That's an interesting chart. Next slide, please. And here's our COVID-19 vaccinations. It just occurred to me, I bet you next month there will be more doses administered than total COVID tests that we've taken, which will be pretty cool. But I'm just going to gloss over the numbers because my hunch is Dr. Madden is going to talk a little bit more about COVID vaccinations. But this data sheet has proven to be very helpful for us. And if you are going onto our website, now it's just Fridays, but initially it was Monday, Wednesday, Fridays, then Wednesday, Friday, and now just Friday when we update our vaccination page, we present all of this. So it's a pretty transparent way to communicate to our community kind of what's going on. Next slide. And this is more detailed information. It's very gratifying to see the upper ages of our community with such a high percentage of their series completed. But it is also gratifying seeing the other side of that curve begin to get filled into, because it just means that we've vaccinated the most vulnerable in our community, and now it's really this march to to community immunity by just putting as many needles in arms as we can. And you know, we're up to the typical week right now we get about 1,100 and it's been Moderna the last couple of weeks, 1,100 Moderna shots. And we schedule about 3 days of 330, 350 first shot appointments. And then whether it's Moderna or Pfizer, it's Pfizer this week, but we schedule about 1,000 Pfizer booster shots. So we are doing over 2,000 shots a day. It's the equivalent of a mass vac site damn near 7 days a week. Kudos to the team and the work that they're doing. Next slide, please. Dunya presented on this during her earlier presentation, but I'm at the end of my presentation. I'm happy to take any comments you may have for me with respect to this work. Next slide. Okay, I wanted to talk a little bit about the work we've been doing with our master site plan, kind of introducing this to the board and how we are attempting to get our arms around addressing some short-term needs with some longer-term bigger needs. Next slide. So I think many of you are familiar with, all of you, I think, are familiar with the master site planning process that we went through last year, where Jefferson Healthcare, we engaged Coates and Associates and health facilities planning to basically bring together a bunch of different voices regarding the master site plan and the facility needs and service needs for the organization for the next 10 years. Process included, multiple meetings with hospital staff, multiple staff. We had a meeting with local community representatives. It was long enough that they are all no longer here, but gave us their perspective. We had a couple of community meetings. I remember one at the Chimicum Library, basically talking about trends in healthcare that we saw and trying to pull input and feedback from as many different people as possible. And the goal was to develop a plan that certainly identified and addressed necessary facility improvements and expansion needs, and identified new service opportunities, growth opportunities, and try to get a sense for overall community sentiment toward Jefferson Healthcare. Because depending on the scale of the plan, it might require community participation in the funding of that plan. Next slide, please. So the process, Coates was the architect that was on point. Jody Corona, Health Services, Health Facilities and Planning, provided the utilization review data and the demographic data to help us understand for a community our size with our age demographics, how many prostate cancer procedures are we seeing and how many should we expect to see based on what we know about prevalence of that disease. So a pretty robust analysis of by Jody that she all put into a executive report that we were able to kind of scan and help us to determine specialty needs in the coming years. As you might imagine, a whole lot of services where the need for the need of the service was slightly less than a 1.0 or significantly left. So there's no question this community has a need for a service, but but less than one FTE, or certainly less than two FTEs. And so you're kind of caught with how best can you meet that need. The process also identified existing growth opportunities and new service growth opportunities and technological innovations which may impact care delivery systems. We spent a lot of time talking about the impact of telehealth and virtual health and seeking your healthcare from your computer in your den versus coming into a facility for it. And we were having these discussions kind of right at the tail end of, right when COVID was beginning to rear its head. So it was a more relevant discussion then than I think it's ever had been, because there was a real need for telehealth the last year, maybe than years prior. And then the architect came up with three, four, or five kind of expanded new facility configurations, sized and scaled to meet the Jefferson healthcare space needs for 10, 20 plus years. Next slide, please. So a couple of additional comments. The timing of this work was challenging, given we step into these master site plan meetings, and you know that you're charged with being really creative and thinking out of the box and being fully engaged and committed to that planning work, and you know the 3 hours before that meeting and the 4 hours after that meeting, we were all, in the Dirksen conference room trying to figure out how to stand up a testing site over the weekend, or trying to figure out how we're going to keep our patients safe or our employees safe when there are no N95 masks to be found. So it really was this challenge of, didn't create the best environment for creative and free thinking, because I think we were so preoccupied on COVID. Secondly, the final product was huge in scope, scale, and ambition, and expense, and maybe tied to a successful bond campaign. And the concern this created for me is that while everything included in that big project is necessary, not all of it has the same. Not all of the projects have the same urgency, and some projects, some space needs, some service growth needs are more urgent and need to be addressed before maybe this bigger package. So the way I am recommending we deal with that disconnect is a four-phase master site plan that allows for immediate planning and development of critical space while continuing to plan and position for a more comprehensive check all the boxes solution. Next slide, please. So basically, the first two phases of the four-phase master site plan are the projects that we have been talking about the last month or so, or two or three, and that I will introduce tonight and then come back tomorrow, at our next board meeting with more information. So phase one is basically what minor projects can we do to create more capacity from existing services where the demand is there? And one idea is to expand surgery pre-op and recovery space so we ultimately improve throughput. That it doesn't matter how many operating rooms you have, if you have limited or inadequate pre-op and recovery space, it kind of clogs up the works, to introduce a concept that Bruce is probably familiar with. So I tasked Tina with how can we make sure that those two spaces, the pre and post experience for our patients, are adequate in size, designed to move flow smoothly, and in essence, create more capacity out of existing operating rooms because you can turn them over faster. So Tina is working on that project, and I suspect next month I'll have an estimated cost. Secondly, and initially this just began a discussion of how can we increase mammography capacity, because that's frequently a service that our patients wish we could provide sooner. So we began looking at carving out an additional mammo room, and then that discussion, which included Drs. Madden, Butterfield, and Harris, quickly went to, well, how could we make our breast services more comprehensive in this community and meet more women's needs? Our MRI system has the capability of adding a breast MRI coil, which would allow us to introduce that service to our community at not a significant cost. So we are moving forward with that. And also, in addition to being fairly far down the analysis of adding another 3D mammogram, we are looking at adding a stereotactic biopsy device on that system, which provides another less invasive biopsy option for our providers and our patients. So started out with just how can we create more capacity? And, you know, as is the case when Joe, Steve, and Tracy are in the room, here's how we can make this better. And I think that's where it's going to end. So we will be excited to present that to you next board meeting. Then in phase two of the master site plan, the big project is additional office space for our new women's clinic, our new derm clinic, and an outpatient surgery center. There very well may be other services that go into that building. We sort of will view it as a multi-purpose specialty services clinic, and it's just a function of we didn't think of this at the time, but we undersized the ESSB. And if we're going to continue to provide specialty services to our community, we need more space, and we think this is the most effective way to get that space. My plan next board meeting is to talk about the process that we will undergo, which will lead us to go, no go on proceeding with the project, because it's, you know, it'll likely be a $20 million project. Demonstrate to you how it positions us and all of the needs that it meets. And basically, it's an investment now that is part of the master site plan bigger building. So you make the investment in this building now, meet your immediate needs, and the next phase project becomes $20 million less. Then the next slide is if general surgery comes over because of the endoscopy center and outpatient surgery centers that are on the top, then that still is really, really great space, and we would need to retrofit that. Phase 2C is our medical oncology services have outgrown their space. So by moving dermatology into this new space, derm would, or med-onc would be able to expand into where derm is. So it solves that problem. So I learned a long time ago to introduce big items in smaller chunks. So consider this the introduction. The good news is that it's a plan that will keep up with the growing needs of our community and will allow us to improve and expand the specialty services and outpatient surgery needs of our community. The challenging news is that it will require a not insignificant investment. And I should also mention that we are looking at a potential primary care portion of the medical office building as well.
Bruce, it looks like you have your hand up.
Yeah, Mike, I know that we talked about it, about oncology radiation. Where would that fit in on this?
Next slide, Brittany. So that was perfect. The next phases are 3A, 3B, and 4, and that's when we start doing the work associated with retrofitting the 88 building, and while we are doing that, adding to the 88 building. We have to retrofit it for seismic and I think some electrical and mechanical improvements. And we have identified a space for a linear accelerator that's down by radiation. Kind of for the, Mari would know where this is. It's where the pad for the mobile MRI used to go, Mari. That area could accommodate a linear accelerator quite well. And that would be the next phase of this project that we would sort of shoot for beginning in 2023. In addition to that, deal with the 65 building, and we've known this has been coming for quite some time too, but we are leaning toward just a replacement project of the building that we are all in and replaced with new and improved space. And then phase four, and this is more kind of, wouldn't this be cool? At least part of this anyway, but that is an on-site primary care center. That's the part that I think we need to do. But there's also some fascinating models to embed aquatic therapy and wellness center services within a primary care either facility or campus. And we purchased that block of land over by Manresa Castle potentially for this purpose.
Mike, yeah. I know Casey's got his hand up, but before that, could you please explain where the 88 building and the 65 building are? For those who may not know.
Yeah, the 65 building is the cafeteria and the administrative hallway and we used the old medical short stay. So my hallway and Caitlin's hallway and down that way. That's a big portion of the 65 building. The 88 building starts off where the old emergency department used to be, the laboratory, diagnostic imaging, that big rectangular that attaches to the 65 building, right about where the Puget room is. So where the MRI is, I'm told the MRI is in the 65 building, but when we upgraded it, to so that it meets code. It's easy to look. You look at a as the bird flies or an overhead shot, and you can tell by the buildings with the really old looking roofs. but according to our engineering reports, the 65 building would require significant improvements to the point where the recommendation was tip it over and start fresh. The 88 building, on the other hand, would require, you know, $500,000 to $1 million seismic and electromechanical improvements. So that building is still in reasonable shape.
Thank you. Case?
Two questions on that. Do those numbers reflect the years in which they were built?
Yeah, yes, sure.
Okay. That's helpful. And could you go back one slide to your very beginning phase one that says now? It says the estimated cost is to be determined. Are there any ballpark bookends on that at this point?
Yeah, 100 to 200,000. I actually had those numbers on the slide till this morning, because they are swags, but I think if it got north of that case, we probably would scratch our heads and wonder if there was enough return in doing that work. But I think we'll be able to do it in that range.
And then the year, I mean, that says now, which is 2021. And then for 2A, you've also got 2021. Is that when you would see completing the plan for it and figuring out the financing, but actually not quite starting construction or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. At the April meeting, I am going to update you on this work and probably outline a launching point to begin to explore that project that will require spending money on consultants, engineers, and project managers. When I explain that to you and the board says, yeah, that's a reasonable thing, it's a reasonable investment to make, that will sort of be the official starting point. We spent a lot of time talking about organizational needs and how they could be met and where and in what form. And we, leadership thinks that this, is the best solution. But we haven't spent any money on consultants yet. I think the ask next month will be, here's what we plan to do for the next 90 days, and here's where we think we will be, and what I will be asking from you next.
Thanks.
All right. Is there another hand pop up?
I have a quick question. So will part of the consultants be helping us with a community health needs assessment or studies to, especially for the big project?
The consultants won't be working on the big project. The consultants will be helping us develop a feasibility study for the medical office building that will house specialty services and outpatient surgery clinics. So no,
do you feel we have enough community health needs data to justify the big build, the $20 to $25 million project?
Yes. These are services that our community is saying we need more of. A great example is dermatology, that we don't have the space to adequately provide for. Another example is women's clinic, that Dr. Skorberg and Dr. Luckman are wonderful and gracious, but that's a one provider clinic space that we have three providers in right now, and it's exceeding our budget projections on necessary work. So this particular project is expanding to meet existing growth needs and chasing after additional growth needs that we think will help the facility financially in order to do more of the community health work that that a community health study may indicate.
Thank you.
Any other comments, questions?
Okay.
That's exciting, very exciting to go for. I remember thinking that the EES building was going to be, remember we were going to keep the whole top floor open?
Yeah.
Future, and that lasted about a year.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. That was
it's wonderful that we've grown so much and can provide more services to our community, and the city can be better.
Yeah, exactly, especially the women's clinic, which I've been trying to encourage us to have for what 30 odd years, and now as it has been, and taking care of our patients is superb. And if we can find them a really good place, a site where they can accommodate the three providers adequately, that would be great.
Okay. But you'll get lots of information about this, and we'll take it slow in small chunks, and there'll be multiple points to say proceed or hold back. For those of you who remember the ESSB, I think it was like 4 or 5 different go no go points. We're gonna, you know, here's the amount of money we're spending in the next 90 days. Are you in? It'll be a similar process.
Great.
Okay, that concludes my report. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mike. Very good. Excellent. And look forward to next month and more. And that segues right into our Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Matter.
Hi, good afternoon. So I had this thought that maybe, you know, 1 year since, you know, COVID pandemic really, you know, we kind of that became all encompassing. I had this idea that the CMO report would be about mostly things non-COVID, and I guess I could, you know, say that there's we're getting a little more work back on some opioid quality and opioid prescribing safety, and I could tell you our staffing is good. I could tell you we're doing some informatics work to help with single sign-on. We have some other ideas of projects for provider workflow and, you know, beginning to try to, you know, get deeper into health equity. And that's all happening. And we're even thinking about ACO. But to be honest, really, still, if you think about what makes takes most of my time and still pulls the most on the other medical officers, it's still COVID. And that's probably a good metaphor for where we're at, right? We kind of want to move on. We want to kind of refocus on these other things that are super important. But the reality is, you know, across the state and across the country, we're at a very tenuous spot. Cases have plateaued. They're not as low as they need to be. We have some things trending in our favor, and we have some things working against us. So things opening up, but vaccinations increasing. And so it's a really tricky time. And I think one of the key messages is I'm going to spend the rest of my report mostly, you know, kind of talking about the vaccine program, which is just want to make the point we can't kind of take our eye off the ball yet. We're not there yet. You know, we're anticipating folks traveling spring break. We're trying to remind our workers, even though we have a significant portion of our healthcare community that is vaccinated, that we still need to be cautious. It's still a time when numbers could increase, particularly with variant strains and the UK strain in particular, which is more infectious, beginning to predominate across our region and across the country. So so it's a difficult time, but and so from a CMO report, it's probably best I spend most of the time talking about our in particular the vaccine program right now. So a few things on numbers, and actually just real quick on epidemiology. You're probably aware that the numbers have been down in Jefferson County, which is good. Of the few cases over the last couple weeks, actually several of them have been on the west end of our county. And so cases in East Jefferson have been luckily limited. So that's good news. But again, we should be cautious about that. On the vaccination side, I'm happy to say that the North Olympic Peninsula has really continued to lead the way. We are currently, it's been Jefferson and Clallam. When you look at the state database and dashboards about percentage of population receiving at least one dose and then completing vaccine, Clallam was held the first place for a while. We've jumped ahead of them, so we're in first place for a little while. It sounds like Clallam County it's going to get another boost because I think the tribe is going to open up and expand their eligibility a little bit before the state. So they'll probably, maybe leap ahead of us. But the important thing is that as a region, that's a really good thing. I mean, it's great for us to be successful in our county, but it's also really great to know that our adjacent regions are doing really good work too, given, how much our population's kind of across. And so Mike had the statistics up earlier locally just for our program, but just to keep in mind right now that it's probably by the end of this week, you'll see close to 45% of Jefferson County residents will have received at least one dose, and will probably be over 30% or close to over 30% of people who have completed their series. And that's a really remarkable thing. And that's, remember, not just our work, but the work of, shout out to the health department who are going to be running their second vaccination event, to the local pharmacies, QFC, Safeway, and Tri-Area, who've really helped get folks vaccinated. So we're in a really good spot. The state supply of vaccine has is anticipated to be at about 400,000 vaccines a week for the next couple weeks. And then the good news is that they are signaling to us an anticipated jump in supply for the state to about 600,000 vaccines a week. So that'd be about a 50%, boost of vaccine supply to the state coming in early to mid-April. And I think that has significant implications for the state opening of who's eligible to the vaccine. We're hoping that that will, what will come with that is expanded eligibility for folks above the age of 16 across the state. One downside is that we are also getting messaging that in leading up to that expansion, there is news that Jefferson County may see its supply of new vaccine doses cut from, we've been receiving about 1,200 a week, that may reduce for the next 2 to 3 weeks to 600 a week. So that messaging is coming through Dr. Locke, that the state allocation plan, in an attempt to improve allocations to other areas that don't have the numbers that we do, and based on our population, that we may see a reduction in new vaccine supply to Jefferson County. They've been making noises about that for a couple weeks, and luckily we had not seen it. So we're planning for that. If we get more vaccine, that's great. But we're anticipating that our scheduling for new patients may decrease for the next couple weeks. Booster doses for what we've given, we are anticipating matching what we've given. So that is good. I think people are probably aware of the expansion of eligibility you've lost track of what's a phase and what's a tier, I don't blame you. It's kind of confusing at this point, but what is supposed to happen across the state on March 31st is expansion for the remaining of what they're saying is the 1B phase, which is tiers 3 and 4. That's people over the age of 60, so now 60 to 64, and people 16 and older who have two or more comorbid conditions, as well as remaining high-risk workers in congregate settings. We're anticipating, if we're having a hard time filling slots next week with our existing tier, which is those high-risk critical workers in agriculture and fishing and food processing and grocery and public transit, we're having trouble filling. We may be pulling people forward. We've talked about that plan with Dr. Locke, who's in agreement. So we are encouraging as many people who are going to be in this next opening to get signed up through our website, because we know that we may be pulling some of them forward if we have open slots. So we're sitting in a good place right now. You also may be aware that as far as vaccine distributions in the last few weeks, the state has we've asked for Pfizer vaccine, and they have provided Moderna vaccine. So we are we're adaptable, and we've adapted with that. And at this point, though, we would like to be more consistent. So we're going to be primarily requesting Moderna vaccine moving forward to try to just make it a little bit simpler from a management and scheduling standpoint. So we'll see if they we ask for Moderna, and then they ask us if they want Pfizer. We're hoping that we'll just be able to kind of stay consistent moving forward, particularly supply opening up. A few other things just to note about the program. We still are reaching out to different communities and trying to make sure people aren't left behind. We had some additional language support for individuals where English is not their primary language this week. And so we've been working with community organizations, I think, as I mentioned before, to make sure, particularly for Spanish-speaking population, to make sure that we're getting folks connected. We also are continuing to run a walk-in clinic for individuals who require public transportation or have some additional needs where and out of the car in a clinical space or being in a room with a provider makes more sense. And so we're directing folks into that clinic as appropriate to make sure that, again, the whole vaccine program is accessible for the whole community. The next thing I want to talk a little bit about is, I think you're aware of the dosing concern that happened on March 4th. So in a pool of about 150 vaccines that were given, we became aware the morning of the 4th that a portion of those vaccines were likely primarily the diluent. So they were likely just trace amounts of the vaccine, but mostly the diluent. And that led to a pretty quick analysis of what happened that morning. And at some point, I'm going to guess that Brandy Manuel will give you the full conclusions of the analysis, which is still finishing up. You know, when we have an event like that, so in that situation where we learned, it was actually because of our, we have a reconciliation process to make sure that doses given match up with the doses drawn, and we realized there was a discrepancy, was how we realized that there was a portion of those vaccines, we think around an estimated around 36 to 40 vaccines that morning that were primarily diluent with less, you know, more likely sort of trace amounts of the vaccine in it. So when we do that, we do kind of the quick, and then we do, the quick immediate. What do we need to do differently? Let's do the quick analysis, understand if there's anything in our process that needs to change. And we made some quick modifications to our process and did some quick competencies and retraining of some staff to make sure that would not happen again. And then we have a deeper analysis that takes place after an event like that, which is being completed to make sure there are no other learnings. So I think moving forward, if you're really good about how things are happening, that this would not happen again. harm for the patients. Unfortunately, that's just the first and foremost, just the kind of anxiety of, wait, was I one of those people in the 150 that got an overly diluted vaccine and probably underdosed. So what we've done, and I think Mike has made you aware of kind of the strategy, we got together and figured what would be the best course, because we believe that morning the vast majority of people got the standard dose of Pfizer vaccine. And so what we wanted was a strategy to manage this situation where we didn't give any unnecessary extra doses of vaccine to individuals. And we also made sure no one got underdosed ultimately or didn't have a series that was incomplete. So after discussing with our local health jurisdiction and Dr. Locke and then consulting with the state, we decided to offer antibody screening, which has been taking place this week. And we can test for an antibody against the spike protein, which is what the Pfizer vaccine targets. Between 14 and 21 days is when most people will begin to develop some antibody production. It's not a perfect test because people can have a delayed immune response in particular. And so it's possible, whether because of underlying medical conditions or because of age, that you could receive a dose of the vaccine that was standard and still have a negative result for the antibody test. But a positive antibody result is actually extremely helpful because, particularly in our low prevalence county, it is most suggestive that they receive the full standard dose of the vaccine on March 4th. So this is the week that we're drawing the antibodies for the vast majority of patients are choosing that path. And with the antibody results for folks who end up with a negative result, we are offering them another vaccine appointment on April 15th for a third shot, which will represent for a number of these folks the second standard dose of the vaccine. So our staff has been really great with that. We've been very transparent with the community. We wish we didn't have to do this approach, but we think it's the approach that will get the folks who need, get everyone the proper dose of the vaccine and minimize the harm and not give unnecessary doses to folks who don't need it. So that's the process. That's what's happening this week. So staff is reaching out and beginning to communicate with those patients as those results come in. We did get a chance to talk to a work group at the CDC about the plan. We did some question and answer, talked about alternatives. They felt good about folks who may want to just receive a third dose of the vaccine, or if we end up dosing individuals with third dose, they felt comfortable from a safety standpoint with that. So when we're able to kind of talk back and forth about the logic and the rationale behind our antibody testing, they seemed to understand the rationale and thought it was a reasonable plan. So we feel good about it. We feel like it's a way to make the best of the situation from that morning. And so so that's where we're at with that. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have regarding that. But for that group from the 4th, this Thursday, so it's tomorrow, is the day that they will all be coming back for their previously scheduled second shot. So other than that, the only other things I will tell you moving forward with the vaccination program is we're beginning to talk about the next phase of the program. So, we've gotten through a large bunch of our population. I think hopefully with more vaccine supply, we expect to get back to the hopefully, close to 2,300, 2,400 vaccinations a week, and move through the you know, a large chunk of the Jefferson County population. But then, you know, we need to begin thinking about how to incorporate the vaccination program into our everyday practice. And so that getting a shot for COVID should begin to feel a little bit like if you're getting a shot for your flu shot. So if you're coming in for a primary care visit, you're coming in for a specialty visit, you're being seen, you're in the hospital, how do we start vaccinating other folks in those settings? So we're going to begin the planning of incorporating that, particularly with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine available, that may make distribution in the clinics this year a little bit easier. And then other strategies that we're going to have to start thinking about. Right now, the problem has been more demand than supply. We are going to be moving into a more vaccine hesitant population. And so we're going to begin to think about how are we going to communicate and work for the group who has been more hesitant in our community. We're going to start with our own employees. You know, we have we're in a great place with 80%, but there's a portion of our own employees who have been vaccine hesitant. So we're going to revisit with that group and try to do some ongoing communication and see if we can get those folks who were kind of waiting to see if we can bring them into the fold and then get them vaccinated. And then I think that's going to be a strategy we're going to need for the whole community. So that's where we're going. And I'll stop there and see if anyone's got questions.
Any questions from anybody? Any commissioners? Case, you're muted.
No, thank you.
I've got a Mari, did you want to make a comment?
No, thank you.
Mari?
No, thank you.
Okay. Well, first of all, I heard at the Board of Health meeting that, and perhaps you could confirm this, Joe, that in fact, for the vaccination clinic that they had in Chimicum last weekend, that two things. Number one is, first of all, it was an incredible community-supported effort, and they got 30 vials of the Moderna vaccine and were able to get 11 shots out of each of the 10-shot vials. So they actually ended up giving 330 shots as opposed to 300. And I heard that was from the supply that Jefferson Healthcare got. Is that correct, Joe?
Yeah, they were able to get 11 shots consistently. I heard the same thing from Dr. Locke. And we donated 20 of those vials. So we were able to move that over. And we thought it was really important to support, too. The volunteers had been kind of chomping at the bit. And they needed to train because when the vaccine supply opens up and we have a bigger population of maybe 6,000 people, you know, we're going to need some of those events to supplement what we're doing if we want to get people vaccinated quickly. So and then they were able to actually, I believe they've got 30 new vials coming for this coming weekend that they got on their own that we didn't have to allocate any. But yeah, we've definitely been working with them all along. So it's definitely been a collaborative effort.
And I heard that there are still spots open. So if anybody knows of anyone who is in the right age group, they still have places available for appointments there. And that the best source is the Jefferson County Public Health has a great website where you can see the phone numbers and the contacts for each of the pharmacies for Jefferson Healthcare. And then it also gives you a link to signing up for the Chimicum event.
Any other comments from the board? Okay. Well, kudos to you and your team, Dr. Mattern, for the innovative ways you've developed for making sure you're reaching every member of our community for vaccinations. It's great. Thank you.
Yeah, and definitely team effort. And so important when you think about the fact that we don't have, you know, we don't have a lot of herd immunity in Washington state because compared to the rest of the states, I think we're 45th as a state in, you know, number of COVID cases, despite the fact that we were, you know, at the beginning of it. But if you look at Jefferson County, you know, without the vaccinations, we had we've had such low prevalence of disease that, you know, this is the way for us to get safe. We don't have a lot of people walking around here who have, you know, immunity because they had previous infections. So to get so many people vaccinated so quickly, we could still be looking at a fourth wave as far as number of cases, but at least I feel better that a higher risk group of our in our population is vaccinated. So it makes the likelihood of a fourth wave of hospitalizations, particularly for Jefferson County residents, less likely.
Good point. Thank you. Thank you for your report. All right. And thank you for all of your
hard work. Actually, Jill, I have a question. Jill, I do have.
Yes. Mari, I think that's Mari.
I do have a question. Yes. If one has been vaccinated, is there any research or any information regarding if people do get infected? Those who've been vaccinated, I think, is less likely to be hospitalized, less likely to have severe disease. Is there any information about that? Are we far enough into it to have any research regarding that issue?
You know, yes. You know, and when we go back to, you know, just even the initial approvals, remember the thing that the studies was that they were designed to show were decrease in symptomatic COVID. And so it's been this whole other question of does it cut down on asymptomatic infection, or does it prevent infection? And there's been actually a growing body of evidence to show that you cut down on acquiring infection and cut down on asymptomatic infections. In the real world, you are seeing some changes. And, you know, just one of the things that just came across my mailbox was an article looking at just healthcare worker illness and showing that vaccinated healthcare workers, they've seen a big drop in illness, COVID illness with vaccinations. And so it's actually, I sent that to the other chief medical officers and Caitlin Harrison, saying that this is important information for our vaccine hesitant healthcare workers to understand, is seeing that the things you really care about, right? I mean, you want to make sure, you certainly don't want to bring it home and get anyone sick, but you also want the proof that this is a intervention that is going to keep you out of the hospital, is going to keep you out of the emergency department, and so there is the body of evidence in the real world is supporting that.
And I might add to that Dr. Locke stresses the fact that even those vaccines that have less than a 95% efficacy are 100% effective in preventing hospitalizations and deaths.
Yeah, it's a great point. There's been a little bit of the, you know, which is the favorite vaccine. And, you know, I got mine was 95% effective and I don't want the one that's, you know, 79%. But when they talk about efficacy, they're really talking about any, you know, COVID illness or, you know, symptoms. So, Case is absolutely correct, which is that when you look at preventing hospitalizations and severe illness and death, all the vaccines have been shown to be incredibly effective. And I like to say what Dr. Locke does. I've been telling patients, you know, his phrase, which is, you know, once you're fully vaccinated, you're probably going to die from something else. Not COVID. It's a good way to think about it. You know, there are other things that unfortunately, to put you in the hospital, but probably COVID's not going to be one of them.
Bruce?
And one add-on question, if I may.
Okay. Go ahead, Mari.
Shall I go ahead? If this long COVID disease that hangs on with brain fog and various other issues, are we seeing any of that in our community?
Because we have a low prevalence, we're in a situation where we haven't, we just don't have as big a population to kind of learn from that way. I've spoken with at least one patient who was definitely having some lingering symptoms and had discussed, and we haven't kind of gone back and looked at that. We do have a record of who's been infected, and we've talked about kind of circling back to see. We are starting to see practices and clinics pop up in the Puget Sound area to address folks who have the long hauler or kind of long COVID syndromes. And this is going to be a real thing. And this is, once we get, you kind of pick our heads up and you're seeing the number of acute infections, drop, and the leftover implications or the sequelae of this, we don't fully understand yet, but there's going to be a part of our population that is going to be working to recover for this for a much longer time than when they had their infection. And what we're learning is that even people who had mild symptoms initially were sometimes weeks later showing up with this long hauler syndrome. There's also anecdotal reports about the impact of the vaccine on those individuals, and that in a number of cases it may help, and in some cases actually could be worse. So we don't really fully understand. So we will be talking about COVID for a long time and its impact on health. There's going to be a population that we still will be trying to understand the full impact years from now.
Bruce?
Yeah, Dr. Mattern, because all the things that we've done in the county as far as prevention, as far as masks, social distancing, hand washing and things, what do we know about the impact on influenza?
Well, you have to think that it's potentially played a role. It's difficult because so much of the traveling through the fall and the winter was disrupted, and what was going on in the southern hemisphere. And so we think about, we've started to ask ourselves, what will flu seasons look like just for hospital workers moving forward? People will kind of talk about, I can't wait till I get rid of the mask. But if you're a healthcare worker, I think we may think differently about healthcare workers and PPE and when we wear it. And it may not be going away that in certain times of the year, whether you have vaccination or not, you're wearing different equipment. We've seen other respiratory and, cold viruses go down. And when you look at when you look at the decreased ED volumes, one of the things we talk about with that is this was not a normal year in a lot of other ways. So there's been a cost for the isolated person with chronic respiratory disease who's been living at home, and they've certainly, their quality of life might not be good, but they may have been spared at least exacerbations of their underlying respiratory illness because they weren't seeing other folks. Now, I think if you asked them and said, if it's between whether I get a exacerbation of my lung disease or I see my grandkids, I need to see my grandkids, right? And so I don't think we will certainly have learned things from this. And I think there's just no doubt that, when you have communicable diseases, the less people are communicating, the prevalence of those things go down. And so what will take time to sort out is what stays with us moving forward. And I think particularly in healthcare settings, this was an unusual year to say the least. And I think, as people start to move around again, I would anticipate that come in this fall, I'm actually pretty worried about the flu season because there's going to be so much pent up demand of what people didn't do this past year that they feel they need to make up for time. And I think the movement of people is going to be increased. And I think there won't be a huge amount of desire outside the hospital to wear masks and PPE. I could be wrong. We'll see what happens. But I think it could be a bad flu year this year moving forward. So Time will tell, but we're going to have to be on guard for that. And COVID, there will still be coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, with us for a long period of time. So this year, next time, 1 year from now, we may be, you know, talking about our, you know, how many people are in the hospital for flu and how many for SARS-CoV-2. So.
Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Mattern. Are there any other questions, comments? Thank you, Dr. Mattern. Very good in-depth report. Thanks. Okay, then we will move on to board business. And first is the Board of Health report case. Would you like to give your report, please?
Sure. First of all, just to finish up on the whole COVID pandemic, it was the communicable disease, emergency preparedness, and the immunization staff at public health that really put in countless hours in the recent months to partner with the Department of Emergency Preparedness to provide the mass vaccination clinic. They actually did several dry runs to make sure that it went smoothly. So you can imagine setting up this this site took an enormous effort, and apparently it went very well. So on the non-COVID front, believe it or not, there is activity out there in the world that's not related to that. Public Health actually successfully hired and oriented a new practitioner, Dr. Melinda Bauer, and everybody's very excited about her presence. She's going to be the person running their sexual and reproductive health main clinic, as well as serving the school-based health centers in both Chimicum and Quilcene. So this is really very good news because those are both very important local services. Most of the time during this past Board of Health meeting, we're spent talking about the bills in Congress that are looking at the regionalization of local public health districts and efforts. And the very good news is that the bill that passed the House on March 8 is very, very different from what people, including us, had all feared. And is really proposing something that seems to be a workable solution to improving public health services. First of all, there's a large part of that which is for funding of foundational public health services, which have been grossly underfunded for decades all across the country, including here in Washington State. And so there, the legislature is finally beginning to consider some reasonable funding, even though it's probably only 30% of what is actually needed to bring the foundation of public health services up to any kind of quality standard across the state. What it's doing, rather than this proposed legislation, what it's doing is, rather than eliminating local health jurisdictions, which is something that we were terribly concerned about all across this county, is actually adding a different tier of public health services into what are called four regional health districts. We would be in one of those four regional districts. And what it would add is an additional public health officer and a public health service center to the regions that would then provide additional services to the local health jurisdictions. So it would not eliminate local control. It would not eliminate the local
health officer, and it would provide backup to the local health officers by a regional health officer, and provide additional epidemiologic services that that are really important for us to beef up our public health services all across the state. Unfortunately, the one thing that it does not do is provide a guarantee that those boards of health across the state that are only composed of county commissioners, it does not require that they be expanded boards of health. So Jefferson County and Clallam County have been leaders in the concept of an expanded board of health with representatives from the public hospital district, the city, and citizens at large, that hopefully would provide for a little less politicization of the boards. And as some of you may recall, that was the big issue this year, where some boards of health, in particularly in Eastern Washington, ended up making life so miserable for public health officers who were trying to follow scientific guidance that some of them resigned. And in fact, they outright fired a number of them as well. Because as you recall, the Board of Health is the entity that employs the public health officers. So Dr. Locke and Kate Dean are working actively at the state level to help continue to give input to the fine tuning of this probable new legislation. We're still recommending that it not be implemented right away, not this year, but perhaps next year. Something is going to pass, and we recommend that it not compete with all of the work that public health departments are currently trying to do. But basically, that's good news, and I think the public hospital district, our letter, hopefully helped support our legislators in making the right choice. So I'll keep you posted. Obviously, they're still in session, and I'll send along any additional information as it becomes available.
Good news. That's good news.
Yes.
Does that conclude your report, Case?
Yes, it does.
What other services would be expanded under the new system? Was it just epidemiology?
Well, what it would do is it would offer backup, number one. So if a public health officer is on leave, or if there's some additional help that they would need, it would assist in person power. Second of all, more and more, the requirements of reporting and analyzing data has become more and more cumbersome. When we did our health assessments for this county, we relied on epidemiologic help from Kitsap County. And so rather than have to sort of beg, borrow, and steal and do with limited resources what we're being asked to do, more of this information would be available and coordinated at that regional level. But the actual provision of care would continue to be by locally hired and local public health departments.
That's great. Any comments or questions from the board on Case's presentation? Okay, thanks, Case.
You're welcome.
Any other members of the board have any report or any comments they'd like to make under board business?
Well, if I could, I'm sorry, I didn't see a hand go up, so I'll just add one more quick comment. Once again, I appreciate the opportunity to be working with the Health Equity Committee and with the IHI training, and I mentioned earlier that I'm just totally impressed with the dedication of this organization to do the right thing.
Great. Thank you. All right, then we will go to agenda evaluation. And this is, Bruce, do you have something that you'd like to comment on?
No, I'm just getting ready.
All right. Great. So agenda evaluation, this is not today's meeting evaluation. It's how has the agenda been working for you? Are we presenting the information that you want to hear? How do you think that we have done? Is there something we're lacking, something we're doing too much of? Can we have your comments on that, please? Mari, do you want to go first?
I'm so somewhat biased because I'm involved in helping make the agenda. So I think probably other board members would have more better things to say. I think that most of what we do covers what I feel I need, but my colleagues might have different ideas.
Okay. Bruce?
Well, I'm okay with how the agenda has been going. I think we've been flexible enough that when people want to get some things on there, we know that we need to get a hold of you or Mike or whoever, to get some things on the agenda. And, I think you've done a pretty good job, really, of the time allocation for the different things on there. Sometimes we run over, but that's just the way life is.
True. We're just so opinionated and want so much information. I think that's a good thing. Okay. So, Case?
Yeah, I think I really appreciate the way you and Mari have been putting the agendas together. I definitely like having that time before the meeting so that we can actually talk together as commissioners, because the business meeting is so jam-packed with information that we don't really have the time or make the time to just talk with each other and see what we're really thinking. It's sort of like a quick Q&A and then we're on to the next topic. So I'm really appreciating that that beginning time of connecting.
Okay, good. All right. Matt, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. How about your evaluation of it?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with the agenda process. I don't have any suggestions or changes or modifications at this time, and I really appreciate the work put in to both put it together and the presentations. I think have just gotten really sharp and well done and informative. So I think it's a very efficient use of time.
Great. All right. And I agree with all of you. So then is there anything else under board business that any of you would like to add?
I would just like to muse on one thing, which is that at one point we talked about trying to limit staff slides to 5 slides per presentation. And that was something that I think Karma Bass had recommended or somebody recommended. But really, when you look at all the stuff that we're doing and what we have to pack in, I think that that was probably a totally unrealistic idea. I'm happy with the presentations just the way they are.
I am too. I agree with you.
Good point. I will take that as a challenge because I think that I've I complied with that well for about 18 months, but as of late, I think I've been utilizing this more as better strategy, and I'll carve them down.
Good. Well, it's working.
I actually think it was 7 slides.
I think it was 7 that she said.
Yes.
The bell.
Well, either way, Mike, it's not fair to have smaller print and fewer slides.
Bruce?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that, you know, when we went to one meeting, I think it makes us, I think, a little more efficient. Because we all know that if we went back to two meetings, we'd fill those up too. You know, that's just the way it is. And so we're much better off, and it's easier on the staff and everybody else if we just have one meeting that takes a lot of time rather than two.
I agree. Okay. Well, then, thank you, everyone, for the comments there. And then we will go to the meeting evaluation. How did this meeting go? And we'll reverse it this time. Matt, you're at the end of the alphabet, so you end up being last a lot. So this time you're first.
Yeah, I think it was a great meeting. You know, a lot of intense, interesting stuff in it. And I think everyone did well in how we discussed it and worked together on it.
Okay, great. Okay, Bruce?
Yeah, I mean, we cover a lot of things, and all the reports are really good, and Mike ran off, so I can't make a joke about Hillary's reports being better.
But I see him running back.
But he knows that, too. He would agree.
Yes.
All right. Mari?
Yes, I think excellent meeting, a lot of good information. And from my personal point of view, I would like to have the slides, because with the internet issues I've been experiencing, I didn't get to see all the slides. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, that's too bad with the, you know, it's unfortunate if you have to be on the phone only, you don't get to see all of that. But maybe there's something.
Well, I did actually.
Go ahead.
I did actually get to be online and see some of the slides, but they didn't move on quickly enough, and some of them didn't come up at all. But I get some of the slides.
Mari, maybe you should just come in, and we'll set you up in an office. That because this seems
we've
to be.
We've got an office.
Do you guys have a? You've got a? Yeah.
Yeah,
that would.
That's a good idea. That's a great idea. All right.
Thank you. I'll take advantage of you.
So, Mari, do you have a smartphone?
Yes.
Because you can get an app for Teams on the smartphone, and maybe then it's not necessarily relying on Wi-Fi. You'd have, you know, I don't know.
I do have a smartphone. It's not. It's quite old, and I don't know how smart I am for my smartphone.
We can investigate this in between, and so we've got a month now to figure out how to get you in the loop.
Any minutes? Yes, particularly I just bought a new Dell XPS.
That what?
I said particularly that I purchased in a laptop, XPS, and I think it's the internet.
Yeah.
Everything else is shut down, so it's one of those things. Maybe my router.
Hmm. Well, I think coming in and using the commission office would be a great idea. Okay, so I agree again with everybody that it was an excellent meeting and lots of great information. I'm particularly excited about the master site plan and what's happening in quality and all of it except finances. But I think that's looks like March is going to be a better month, so maybe we'll be out of the woods. And in the meantime, I know we're in excellent hands.
And if I could make a few comments?
Yes.
First of all, I think it's really remarkable that Mike is able to look at the long-term picture when he's struggling with the short-term alligators that are in the swamp, whether it's the finances or the COVID-19 stuff. So I think that's really commendable. Second of all, I'd like to apologize for my computer because, well, I won't say he crashed just at the beginning of the meeting, and that may have shortened the amount of time that we had at the beginning of the meeting. So I will try to check in a little earlier next time and make sure that all systems are go.
Great. Sounds good. All right. Thank you. Is there... Case, if I
can exonerate you.
I'm sorry?
I can exonerate Case because I checked in 20 minutes early but couldn't get on.
Oh, dear.
Apparently time makes no difference.
Mari, your only consolation is that I went into the Sunrise Rotary website and I did buy my tickets. And I want to say that I saw somewhere that Sunrise Rotary is supporting, what was it? Something to do with the COVID-19 stuff for Jefferson Healthcare, or I can't remember where or what it was. But
We have been supporting. We made two contributions to the. Some of them volunteered to help with the COVID clinic. I mean, I just worked through. I worked the parking lot on several occasions at the hospital. You know, volunteering at the hospital, but some of them volunteering. Through emergency management, I believe, to do traffic control. But also we've supported the population health and food issues, and we're trying to find a carpenter or someone who will make little pantries, little free pantries, so that we can expand into, yeah. I think, Quilcene and then another one in Port Townsend.
Yes, that's what I saw. It was the population health support and the food. Yeah, that's great.
Yes.
Okay, if that's all, Mike.
I'll challenge the Noon Club to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, I just want to recognize. What's
go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I want to recognize and give a special shout out to Brittany. This will be the last board meeting that Brittany is on point for. Alyssa is going to resume sort of the executive assistant position for me. Brittany's going to continue to support Jake and our new CFO, Tyler, who will be here for the next meeting, and John French, and do a bunch of other stuff. But I want to thank Brittany for doing a wonderful job, completely seamless transition, great support for these board meetings. If you guys only knew, I was giving her stuff 90 seconds before the meeting started, and she handled it flawlessly. But I appreciate very much her work and wanted to give her a special shout out.
Gee, right. Mike, I didn't know you. I thought I was the only one giving this stuff 90 seconds before. Brittany, you are amazing.
Thank you all very much for the opportunity. I have truly enjoyed working with you, and I hope to be Alyssa's backup and continue learning.
Well, thank you. You've been wonderful. Absolutely.
And I look forward to whatever curveballs you guys throw at me in the next little while.
All right.
Yeah, thank you, Brittany, so very much. You've been exemplary, and you've been so helpful and supportive of the board. So as the secretary, I want to thank you very sincerely, and I'll still come and bug you from time to time. Thanks so much.
I certainly hope you all do. I'll still be here, and I look forward to your visits.
And I would like to second that as well. And just one parting request, if you could just, maybe it should be just a regular policy that at the end of every meeting, or even during, as soon as there are slides, if those could be sent to us on email, then we don't have to maneuver them. We don't have to wait for you folks to maneuver them. We can look at them in our own email at the same time. So that'd be helpful.
I think it would have been more helpful if she would have sent out cookies from the cafeteria to all of us before the meetings.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
I won't admit that until he was delivered the meeting to me.
All right.
That's on our budget, Bruce.
Is there a motion to conclude?
So move.
So move.
Okay. Not everybody at once. Okay. It's been moved and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 It's unanimous.
We're a minute early, guys.
Yes.
Wow.
Goodbye, everybody. Meeting is concluded. Thank you all.
Stay safe.
Bye. Bye.
Yes.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.